Hi, everybody. We are live.
Indeed. Hey, so John, how's it going?
I think COVID-19, everyone's favorite disease slash germ, has achieved the ATP hat trick. We
Yep.
knocked off all three hosts.
Apparently, so the way I think this has happened, this is the headcanon, is that I received it from Lex via your
Yep.
daily
No,
Lex. He
that makes
infected
total
me.
sense.
That he infected me, and then I have now infected you, and hopefully I have not taken down the rest of the people in your house with you. What's the status there?
Yeah, so far so good. I mean, so I've been having symptoms since Monday, and I was testing every day, and I was negative. But on well, what day was I positive? I forget. I texted you when I was
It was shoot yesterday,
Tuesday,
day
right?
before. Yesterday is when you sent the message saying, or like all you sent was the
Oh, you know
like
what threw me
very,
off?
very.
Because today is Thursday because we changed the recording schedule. Yeah. So I was negative on Monday and Tuesday, and then I was positive on Wednesday.
Were you taking evasive maneuvers within the house on Monday or Tuesday, or were you
No, because
assuming it was a
here's
cold?
why. People are always having colds in the house, and
Yeah,
whenever someone has a
no argument.
everyone has a cold, we give them COVID tests and they come up negative and everything's fine. So I had a cold and I was giving myself COVID tests like I do anytime I have a cold and they're coming up negative.
Yeah,
And then
no
on Wednesday
judgment, no
morning
judgment.
and then on Wednesday morning it was positive, and then I immediately retreated to my room where I have been hiding since then. Except
Well,
now I'm
is
down in the
your
podcast studio.
oh, so I was going to ask, is your room the office or is your room your
Yeah.
room?
No, I was in the bedroom.
All right, so what have you been doing to kill time then?
Well, I mean, for the, you know, for the first, 3 days of this, I just basically had a fever the whole time. That's sucky. You know, I mean, I know it's people had it much worse than I have for sure, but I no one likes having a fever. I'm used to fevers breaking, and this like wasn't breaking, so that was kind of crappy. And that, it's not the worst cold I've ever had, but it's a pretty crappy cold. I did get a Paxlovid prescription. And I talked to my doctor, and she was like, "Well, if you don't want to take it, because you don't want any weird side effects or whatever, if you start getting better, that's fine. But if I can tell you that, the third day of your symptoms is probably not the peak, it could get worse. So do what you want to do." And after my third day of symptoms, it was not getting better; it was getting worse. And so I started taking it, and that's what I'm on now.
And so today, how are we feeling this evening?
I mean, I feel like the fever is mostly gone, so all you got is stuffiness, headaches, body aches. It's not a terrible cold. I do credit some of that to the medicine, but who knows, honestly. I just started taking it because I was like, look, if it got better on its own, I wouldn't have taken it. But it wasn't getting better on its own, and I knew I had to do a podcast. So, I did record a podcast on Tuesday, which at the time I'm sure I had COVID, right? Even though I was still testing negative. And that was kind of miserable and involving a lot of coughing and sweating and feveriness. And so, it's part of the grand ATP tradition of all of us podcasting when we are COVID positive.
Indeed. I mean, that is the rule apparently amongst the three of
The
us.
show must go on.
The show
And the
must go
great thing
on.
about podcasting the way we do it is, despite the earlier joking, it is not transmissible to the other co-hosts.
That is true. That is true. Well, as you guys said for me, and I am now saying for you, speedy recovery. If it ends up that Marco and I need to take the bottom half of the show on our own, we'll do that. But I hope you're feeling better soon. I hope that Tina and Kate
Oh
stay
yeah, the rest of the
uninfected.
family. All right, so my son is visiting for a long weekend from
Oh,
school
I
as
didn't know that.
well.
Oh no.
I gave him the option. I tested positive the day we were supposed to pick him up, and I said, "I have COVID. You don't have to come home if you don't want to." He's like, "No, I still come home." So he still wanted to come home, so he's home. We've only been interacting by a FaceTime, right?
Oh,
But so
that
far, everyone else in the
stinks.
house is negative. But I feel like my wife is doomed. Like, how could she not have it, right? I was
Is
like
she
coughing.
sleeping in the room with
Exactly. I'm
you?
coughing all night long right next to her in bed. How could she not have it? So we'll see. She's still negative today, but
Yeah, I
Well,
think
you
the
never
reality
know.
is like she either has it or has already like fought it off. Like there it she's very unlikely to just dodge it. That's very unlikely.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
and I am kind of glad that all the symptoms have been like nose. I don't even have a sore throat really. It's like upper,
yeah, I didn't.
it's like stuffiness, coughing, nose stuff, no
Yeah,
lung
yeah, yeah.
stuff, no, not even any throat stuff. Just so I'm glad
Yeah.
that my symptoms are not worse.
Fever aside, and the fact that you're taking a smidge longer to get over it, it sounds very similar to my experience. Yeah. I mean, I never tested for a fever. I took my temperature. I never looked to see if I had a fever, but I was never like, I never had the chills. I never had weird temperature control problems. I never had a sore throat. If you recall, that was what tipped us off when Aaron said, huh, my throat's kind of sore. I never had that. Super stuffy, and that still lingers the teeniest bit now, but crazy stuffy, particularly in my sinuses. And I was really worn down for like 24 or 48 hours, but otherwise it really wasn't that bad. And I'm not trying to say that like it's not a bad disease. I'm not trying to say people didn't die. I'm just saying
it's just rolling the dice, like
my personal experience. Exactly, my personal experience just happened to be not so bad.
Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of in between you and Lex. Like, I'm not as bad off as Lex was, but I'm definitely not doing as well as you were. And then I think I'm the first one of us to try Paxlovid, and it has a fun side effect. One of the fun side effects it has is that it gives you a weird metallic taste at the back of your mouth.
Oh, I've heard about this. Yes.
Yeah. It only lasts as long as you're taking the medicine, then stops once you take it. And in fact, not only does it, you know, like when you take it, you have the metallic taste and then it fades like before your next dose, basically. Like, so by the time you take your next pill, it's entirely gone because it's two a day, one in the morning, one in the evening. Well, it's sets of three pills anyway. But for anyone who's worried about that, I would say, don't worry about it. I would take this again in a second. Yes, there's a metallic taste in my mouth right now as I speak to you, but it is way better than my brain boiling in my skull. So,
indeed.
Good job, science.
Yeah.
Well, I am sorry, John. I am glad that you and I decided to go through this together. Apparently, we don't care enough about Marco to join him a few months back. Yep. But no, I'm glad.
And kind of like you, I have no idea where it came from. I mean, I never go anywhere, but my daughter goes to school and doesn't wear a mask. It's amazing she hasn't gotten it a million times already. Maybe I got it from her. Yep. I do go out. I went to the eye doctor recently. I go to the grocery store. I wear a mask, but masks aren't perfect. No, no idea. It's just, you know, did not do anything different than my normal life. And I just, my number was up.
Yeah. Yeah. I told Aaron when Declan stopped wearing his mask last school year, this was around spring break of last school year. I was like, oh, we're going to have it before the end of school. Like, it's going to rip through the family. And it didn't. And I think at this point, a lot of the kids were still wearing masks. And we weren't, you know, one of the first in that trend. We were toward the later end, but still a lot were still doing it. And then when, you know, August rolled around and we went back to, and, you know, he went back to school, I remember vividly looking at Aaron and being like, if we get out of September without getting it, I will be flabbergasted. Then I said, if we get out of our January Disney trip without it, I'll be flabbergasted. And then we got home, and then, I don't know, out of nowhere, we got it in, you know, early February. Mm-hmm. So we lasted way longer than I expected. You are still the victor, though, John. You have the HP trophy of the three of us, but only by a couple of weeks, only just. All right. Well, I am sorry about that, but I'm happy that you're here with us. I really genuinely am. And the show must go on. So let's do some follow-up. What was the context for this? This is about getting your data, a copy of your data from Apple. And for the life of me, I can't remember when this came up.
There was an Ask ATP about how to export your messages or something.
I remember
Google Takeout, which is version of this.
Mm-hmm, that's right. So I presume, John, somebody put this in the show notes, privacy.apple.com, where you can get a copy of your data. And a few years ago now, Zach Whitaker at ZDNet back in 2018 did exactly this. And it was funny. Zach went through all the data he received and he said it actually wasn't that much, which in this context is a good thing because it means Apple didn't have that much. Well, if you trust Apple,
no,
it doesn't,
I think they didn't even give him his messages. The reason the data is important here is that it's 2018 is this is before GDPR, I think.
So,
you're wondering why Apple is improving this feature, I'm assuming it's for regulatory compliance, because what his download contained was like, well, here's some metadata about your messages, but not the actual messages. And of course, Apple does have that data, even though it's encrypted. They could give it to you and you could decrypt it with your local machine keys. But they didn't used to do that. But I think now it has improved. So,
fair enough.
You know, why is Apple now making this feature better? Probably for regulatory compliance reasons.
That is true. I did think the post was interesting, though, nevertheless, and it's worth a quick read if you're interested. And then also tell me about iMazing, if you please.
That was a third-party application that a lot of people recommended. I think I've either bought or at least downloaded that application multiple times in the past to try to use it. It's from the old days, back when you used to be able to like mount your iPod as a USB disk and pull things out of it. Remember that? Yep. I believe this software has its origins in that era of devices. Obviously, we're far from that now, but still they have a thing that lets you go onto your phone and pull stuff off somehow. And some people do use that to pull messages.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure how they're doing it. Maybe they're secretly jailbreaking your phone. I have no idea. I don't want to cast aspersions on this thing. But anyway, some people swear by it. They say, this is how I downloaded my messages from my phone onto my Mac to get a local copy. So if you're looking for a third-party application that claims to do that, here's one.
Indeed. Rob Howard writes, with regard to, the context here is I think it was John, was saying it was kind of slagging on Dolby Pro Logic, you know, the original, one of the original surround sound systems.
I didn't. I was saying systems that tried to take a stereo sound and put it into back channels. But there's lots of different ways you can do that. And the specific one that Rob is writing about here is one of the better ones.
Yeah. So I didn't interrupt you at the time, because that was my understanding as well, is that, you know, the system would just kind of make a best guess as to what was in the rear channel. So I obviously didn't know much about this, or then certainly less than I thought I did. So Rob Howard writes, old home surround sound systems didn't rely on guesswork. Dolby systems encoded the rear channels into the stereo channels so they could be decoded later. Not as good as discrete channels, of course, but calling it guesswork probably sells the work of Dolby's engineers a little short. And this is with regard to Dolby Pro Logic. And building on that, and we'll link to Wikipedia, Dolby Pro Logic decoder or processor unfolds, quote unquote, the soundtrack back into its original 4.0 sound, left and right, center, and a single limited frequency range mono rear channel, which was fascinating. I did not think that Pro Logic was that smart, but it turns out it is.
A 7 kilohertz low pass filtered mono rear channel is not ideal, let's say, for a surround, but at least they have a way of getting the signal out as opposed to just taking stereo and guessing. And by the way, the reverse of that is also true. If you have a multi-channel thing and you're watching stereo, every receiver and every receiver-like device thing will have a way to say, well, I'm only getting two channels of sound, but I'll figure out a way to spread it over your speakers in a reasonable way. I mean, that's a little bit easier because it's not like you're not losing information. Worst case scenario, we can just play back those same stereo sounds like evenly throughout the right and left half of the speakers. But it is true that, you know, no matter how many speakers you have, sometimes you're going to be watching content that doesn't match that number of speakers. And sometimes you might not be able to pick a soundtrack, especially in the modern age of streaming, where, you know, back when in the day when you get like a plastic disc, they'd often have different soundtracks on them, the stereo mix and a 5.1 mix or whatever. But with streaming, there's not that much of that. So you're at the mercy of whatever the audio track is. And if your number of speakers matches that, great. And if not, some device somewhere is going to be after doing something for you.
Indeed. I've probably told the story 5 times on the show over the last decade, but I remember vividly when this was probably like 93, 94, something like that. My dad's favorite like party trick in the world, which says a lot about my dad in many different ways, was he would put on the top, I almost said Top Gear, the Top Gun Laserdisc. And we had a Laserdisc player in a Dolby, you know, surround sound setup. And there were times that the plane would, you know, pass from the bottom of the frame to the top of the frame. And ostensibly it's going over the camera and behind you. And it sounded like it was going behind you. And I tell you what, in 1993 or whatever this was, that blew my mind. And then it got even better because we had one of those really ridiculous remote controls that had a physical jog wheel at the bottom, so you could go frame by frame on the Laserdisc, and that was also like earth-shatteringly cool at the time. It was amazing. And of course the fidelity of these frames was straight trash. I mean, it was not quite real player bad, but it was not great. It was like basically VHS bad, and somebody's going to correct me and tell me it was actually better than VHS. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, Laserdisc was better than VHS for sure.
It didn't seem
I don't think the resolution was necessarily better.
But the fidelity in terms of the reproduction, yes. Not,
that's fair.
You know,
that's fair.
Not being filled with noise from various things messing with the magnetic garbage on a piece of plastic tape.
Right. And it could freeze frame without like weird distortion or whatever.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And so that's what he would do. And it just seemed like the coolest thing in the freaking world.
Thing, like back in those days, like, you know, like, you know, talking about Dolby Pro Logic and all these different things. I mean, there were so many amazing, clever hacks done with these old, you know, simple analog formats to try to cram more data or more channels or more tricks into them. And some of them actually worked pretty well. And many of them were from Dolby, honestly. But, you know, I remember I also had, you know, for all of my complaining about how surround sound really isn't, you know, super compelling for me today, we actually had surround sound in the 90s also. We had it pretty early because at some point in the mid-90s, my mom bought this 5.1 Bose system. She basically made like 3 impulse purchases throughout my entire childhood, and that was one of them. and so we had this like Bose surround sound system, and, you know, first it was just from VCRs and whatever was encoded on those. Eventually we got a DVD player, and that, you know, that broadened our horizons a little bit there. But it was amazing for the time. The reason why I don't really care about it. And later on I actually got my own, and it was like this weird college speaker system I had that, like, pretty sure in retrospect fell off the back of a truck because it was really cheap. The eBay description was like got it as a gift, but I already have a home theater system. Yeah, at the time, I was like, that's weirdly cheap. Yeah, looking back on it now, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was probably a different story than what the guy was saying. But anyway, it was a great speaker system. And I had it for a while, and it was great for a while. And that was, I had that all throughout my, you know, college days and DVD player and up until, I think, first Blu-ray player I even had the system. But ultimately, though, you know, I don't find that compelling now, because to me it is kind of like that 90s trick that we've made the trick better over the years, but it's still just kind of like this novelty thing that when I don't have it, I don't miss it. So that's why I'm down on it for myself now. But I don't fault anyone else for caring more than I do. Obviously, I care more than most people do about lots of things, so I understand what that's like. And if you care more than I do about this, more power to you. But all this is to say that all this, you know, crazy, you know, surround hack stuff we had in the 90s was actually pretty decent, and worked surprisingly well considering how little technical sophistication they had to work with.
Yeah, I completely, very emphatically agree. Speaking of surround sound systems and hacks, let's talk about John's Sony HTA9 setup, shall we? We got a lot of feedback about this. Personally, I'm just sitting here smug on my Sonos throne, feeling very good about my world right now. But to come back to the Sony HTA9, if you recall, this was, I'm pretty sure John brought this up. It was considered, you know, we considered it a more baller version of the Sonos setup that I have. The way it works is there's a box. It's like an Apple TV box, and it communicates via, you know, a proprietary wireless thing to four satellite speakers and then optionally a subwoofer. And allegedly it sounds really freaking good. Well, a lot of people wrote into us to say, oh, there's some evidence that this is not as good as we thought. There is a Linus Tech Tips video. I'm not a Linus fan, but we will link it in the show notes nonetheless.
That expression on my face right now. That's not all of his thumbnails.
I think that's why a lot of people said this, because I've seen, he's a popular YouTuber and a lot of people have seen that video. Surely not this many people actually own the,
totally.
HTA9, but some people who do own it did write in.
Yeah, exactly. And so the first bit of follow-up we got was from John Koch. I'm going to try to summarize this as best I can on the fly. It was genuinely fascinating follow-up, but it was extremely verbose, and I'm going to try to do my best here. So John Koch writes, starts off by writing, I'm writing strongly warn you and the listeners about the HTA9. Like you, I took Andrew's recommendation, found the system on sale for much less than the $2,700, but still almost $2,000. The system advertises using 5 gigahertz wireless, and it turns out that's Wi-Fi. 802.11n Wi-Fi. Yes, a wireless technology from 2009. It creates its own Wi-Fi network like Sonos, presumably to bypass contention with other stations in the user's home. The problem is it's freaking terrible at it. It uses a 40 megahertz channel. The other alternatives they could have chosen. It's terrible about choosing a channel. In order to get it to work without dropping out, I had to reconfigure my own home Wi-Fi to not use channels that the HTA9 seemed to like, which is not great, but okay. Other Wi-Fi systems may not be so configurable. The issue for John is that he lives in a townhouse and, you know, has a lot of other adjacent Wi-Fi that he can't control, blah, blah, blah. So John said, sometime after I returned the system, put in a traditional AVR surround speaker setup, Linus Tech Tips posted a video describing an issue with the system affecting his own Wi-Fi. And John finishes by saying, when it does work, it really is incredible in effect and simplicity. But unless you have precise control over your own Wi-Fi and have little external 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi interference, you should stay away from the system, or at least be very prepared to return it. Meanwhile, Ian White writes, I haven't noticed any Wi-Fi interference, but I have a pretty intense mesh Wi-Fi setup with four nodes in a 1,500 square foot space. So it could be that my overkill system can overcome any interference speakers might otherwise cause. One thing I will say is that I do occasionally experience speaker dropouts. That's not desirable. It's not common. It happens maybe once every 2 or 3 months. Fine, not that big a deal, says Casey, but it gets better. And requires me to rerun the built-in RF calibration to resolve it. Not good, Bob. But I still find it irritating the cost. This is something.
This is like when your old iMac, you're like, it's fine, nothing's wrong with it. Well,
yes, this
it
is
does
exactly
randomly
like my
power
old iMac.
Off on a twice a week, maybe, and occasionally yep. corrupts its RAM, and it's, but it's fine. Everything's fine.
Don't worry about it. Don't look behind the curtain. So Ian writes, I still find it irritating, consisting the cost and that the little base station is not that far from all the speakers and has line of sight to all of them. Last, I'll say that I'm no audiophile, but I think the sound is great and nicely immersive. I wasn't aware of the smile curve you guys talked about, but I don't doubt it. I do sometimes wish it was better bringing the dialogue out. So yeah, that Sony magic is maybe not so magical.
Well, that's the problem too, with any kind of wireless system is, you know, if you're going to have wireless speakers, they're super convenient, but guess what? They communicate wirelessly and there's only so much bandwidth, especially if you're in a situation like you're in an apartment or a townhouse where you have a bunch of neighbors real close to you and you have no control over their Wi-Fi and it's bleeding into your space. That can be kind of a mess.
Yeah. This is just like, you know, earlier tonight there was, unbeknownst to me, there was an Apple Music outage. And what I wanted was to get music playing. I had just gotten home. We were out of town. I had just gotten home. I was unloading everything, unloading groceries, had to wash the dishes. I'm like, let me just put on some music. So I asked my HomePods, hey, play the Rolling Stones.
Never heard of them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Siri had not heard of them. It was giving responses like, I'm sorry, I don't find any songs by the Rolling Stones in Apple Music. Like,
cool.
Was there a contractual dispute? And eventually I just airplayed it from my phone and that worked fine. But and eventually I learned there was an outage. But as I was going through all that, I was thinking, like, you know, when our parents came home from a long day and they wanted to put some music on, what they did was they walked over to the stereo. They maybe took out a record or, you know, later on a CD. And then, you know, they would put it in the stereo if it wasn't already there, and they'd hit play and it would play. It wouldn't play 60% of the time. It wouldn't throw random errors halfway through songs. One speaker wouldn't occasionally drop out for a few seconds for no reason. It would just play. Like, that was it.
Sometimes the record would skip.
Really rarely. And then once we went to tapes and CDs, that stopped being a problem too. So, like, you know.
Well, sometimes the machine would eat the tape.
Every technology
has its own problems.
And yeah, if you walked or jumped near the CD player, sometimes that would skip as well.
Yeah, yeah, you gotta
well,
go
but
by the
point
one
is,
the big
like,
buffer.
You know, I feel like with our modern ways of doing things, we've added so much complexity in the name of convenient features or nice abilities. And many of those are great. Many of those features and abilities we really do use and appreciate. But it has come with it a lot of complexity. And so in an area like this, we're like, okay, if you have a home theater speaker system that is communicating between the speakers via a Wi-Fi network or a Wi-Fi-like protocol or whatever it is, like, there's so many layers of complexity there, and that's just one part of the stack. Feeding that is whatever electronic, you know, media source is feeding the TV or receiver or whatever, so there's another point of failure there. And it's like, the more complex you make your system, the more points of failure there are. And the more technical tricks you play, we're gonna make this one automatically smart and have it process the sound in this way to sense where the speakers are and have, you know, room calibration and Wi-Fi, and the more of those things you layer on top, the more likely it is that you're gonna run into weird failures or intermittent problems or bugs in people's implementations. And, you know, electronics manufacturers are not known for fixing bugs really ever. This is a recipe for a system overall and a setup overall in your living room that seems really cool and is really great when it works, but you're just asking for like just periodic weirdness or flakiness or bugs. And I don't know, increasingly as I get older, I'm like, get off my lawn with that stuff. Like, just give me like stuff that works every time.
Well, I don't know. I think Casey Sonos setup shows that wireless speakers that are vaguely smart and communicate with each other wirelessly is not necessarily a recipe for unreliability. It's just that, you know, Sony maybe is not doing as good a job as Sonos in this area. And I feel like the Sony system, as you said last time, it's solving a specific problem that is not solved by other solutions. If you have a crap room where you can't put things in the right place, a regular system is not going to sound good. It'll be reliably bad all the time. Because you just, you know, you can't put the speakers in the right places or they'll bounce sound off of weird places. You need something like this where you're like, this is literally the only place I have to put these speakers. I can't run speaker wire. I need something that's small and I have to put them in weird, awkward places. Can you do something with that? That's what this product is supposed to do. It's just, it seems like it would be better if it did that job without as much, you know, wireless messiness. But everyone who's wrote in about it has said that it does sound really good. And so I think it is solving the problem, and that problem can't be solved without this complexity. Right. So I'm still pro progress. I don't want to go back to big giant speakers like my parents had that are like taller than I was as a toddler. And there's only two of them. And they're, you know, next to a giant piece of furniture where the turntable is.
Right. No, it's funny listening to Marco talk, and it's, you know, tell me you're a HomePod user without telling me you're a HomePod user. Well, whenever I try it, nothing works and everything's broken these days. Yep. Well, okay. To be fair to Marco and your HomePod setup, I can't shout to the Sonos using Apple Music, you know, unless I enabled like Alexa or something. I can't shout to the Sonos.
That's probably
Sonos have its own.
Well, that's exactly
it. Doesn't have its own voice assistant where you can do Hey Sonos or something?
You absolutely. No, it does have Hey Sonos, but to the best of my recollection, that's only about controlling the Sonos. Like, you know, volume up, volume down, move this to whatever room. You know, it's a very limited repertoire. So in the defense of the HomePods, or in the defense of Marco's broken HomePods, you know, I can't do quite as much with my Sonos as he can with his HomePods. But genuinely, it has been, and it's only been a few months, I'll admit that, but it has been pretty much bulletproof. And the thing, I actually did this just 2 or 3 days ago. I keep my Sonos Roam, which is a little, like, you know, Jambox-esque portable speaker. I keep that on a base station. Yeah, right? I love my Jambox so much. Anyway, I took that off of its base station, which is in our room, which is clear on the other side of the house from the screened in porch. And I, you know, mash down on the play button, which is Sonos speak for, you know, continue play, whatever's playing in somewhere else. And take your best guess as to which one of the speakers you want to mimic here, which in my case, there was only one other thing playing, and start playing it right here. Right. So, you know, something was playing on the porch. I mashed down on the play button for a couple seconds. Then it starts playing whatever was on the porch here on the speaker, literally in my hand. Right. And I am clear. Now, we don't have a very big house, but I'm clear across the house, a floor up. I go walking downstairs. I have 3 different Eero base stations in the house. I would assume that if I am on the house Wi-Fi, that I've jumped between Eero base stations at least once. I go downstairs. I walk through the living room, which is playing the same song, into the porch. And I could not hear not a millisecond of difference between what was coming out of my hand and what was coming out of the speakers. As I'm moving between rooms through the house, it blew my mind, because I would have absolutely expected that there would have been some small, infinitesimal amount of latency somewhere, and I heard none. It was amazing. I don't know how it works.
Well, playing back music, you can cheat with buffers, but playing soundtracks to video is much tougher. Yes, you can buffer the video as well, but the Sonos system and the other sound systems don't have complete control over the video unless they themselves make a receiver, which is the hack to get that, or, you know, playing video games or whatever. So the latency issue and sync issues get much harder as the size of the buffer you're allowed to have shrinks.
That's fair.
So I think playing back music, it can just build that sucker up and make sure everybody's synchronized and have no underflow problems. And it doesn't matter if it takes a second or two to build that up, you're fine. Whereas if you, you know, want to hit play on a movie and see audio and video start instantaneously, your buffer can't be too big.
That everything you said, I completely agree with. And it may just be as simple as, you know, buffering and timing, like you said. And the other thing I want to very, very briefly mention is Sonos does have, like, true something or other. I forget the marketing term they use for it. But what you can do is, for the home theater stuff, you can take an iPhone or an iPad. And actually, one thing that's not great about Sonos is they're not very good about updating this for new hardware. I presume because they have to get that hardware in-house and figure out what the microphones are like and blah, blah, blah. But one way or another, you can take an iPad or an iPhone, as long as they're not brand new, and you can go into the Sonos app and you walk around your room as it plays different tones. As you're literally waving the iPad or iPhone up and down in your arms, you look like a friggin' idiot when you're doing this. But
this is one of those things, like, if your spouse walks in on you when you're doing
bad.
There are so many better things for them to walk in on than this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The list of things that are worse is not very long. But nevertheless, they do have this True Tone or whatever, I forget what it's called, where allegedly it will do similar things to the Sony setup that we've been talking about. I am not here trying to say that it's the same. I'm not trying to say that it's better than the Sony or even as good as the Sony. But allegedly, they will do some sort of sound shaping in order to accommodate your room. I mean, I did this and I didn't notice a particularly big difference, but who knows? All right. Mark Johnson writes, with regard to John's woes, and it's not just John, with skipping intro and accidentally, you know, mashing on the touchpad and doing all sorts of various and sundry terrible things. Mark Johnson writes, when using the Apple TV and presented with the skip intro prompt on the screen, don't use the middle button at the top of the remote. Use the play pause button instead. In Netflix and Plex, that button works. The icon on the screen actually has the play pause icon before the skip text. I didn't know that.
Well, a couple things on this. So first, I did, since complaining about it on the last show, I did actually bite the bullet and turn off touch sensitivity on my Apple TV remote just to try that for a while to see if I, you know, and predictably, as soon as I do that, I try to swipe on the thing and then on the main screen to navigate. And of course, it doesn't work. But I'm trying that to see if it helps reliability. In terms of the play pause button, one of the things I didn't mention when I was complaining about apps is forget about the touchpad. I'm some apps that I use on Apple TV, I'll be watching a show and I will hit the play pause button To pause the video, and then I'll go to do something, and then I'll come back, hit the play pause button again to resume the video, and it will start playing 5 minutes in either direction. And I feel like that, yeah, I feel like that is, you know, that is as close to basic functionality fail as you can get with the Apple TV, short of not showing picture or sound, right? Because it's like there's no touchpad involved here. This is not a complicated UI, and it's again, I don't blame the Apple TV. It's the app, whatever app this is doing something terrible. Like that's just like the mortal sin of a playback application. Jump me forward in a show that I've never seen before. 5 minutes when all I did was hit play pause, a non-touch sensitive button on my remote. So angry. So I really hope Apple TV apps get better with time, because a lot of them are really falling down the job.
Well, I mean, I don't use that many apps on the Apple TV.
I do, unfortunately. That's why I do this tour of all the bad programming across the industry.
Because I mean, I'm not trying to argue with your experience. I'm not trying to say you're wrong. But for me, most of my watching is in Plex, Disney Plus, or Channels, and all three of them, I can't recall having had this problem. Maybe I have, and I just don't remember. But certainly not with the frequency that you seem to. So I don't know if it's just so happens that it's not those three apps that you're seeing.
I don't think it's usually the more obscure ones, and I'm counting like Hulu is maybe more obscure than those things. Amazon, I think, is the worst. Probably Amazon is probably the buggiest in terms of, you know, fundamental bugs. Had problems with Hulu. The various HBO apps over the years have been of varying quality. It's, you know, the Apple TV Plus one, I think, is the only one that I've probably never had a problem with. The problem with that one, of course, is I can never find what I was watching, but that's a universal problem.
Just yesterday, I sat down to watch the first episode of Ted Lasso to prepare myself for the new season. I think I'm a day behind already, but you know, this is the time that if you watch one a day, you'll be roughly synced up by the time the new season starts. And for the life of me, the information architecture on the Apple TV app is the biggest pile of garbage. It is so bad. Yeah. Maybe it's just my brain doesn't work the way
just
that
give up and search, because if you have a goal in mind, that UI will fight you every second of the way.
Yes. So
their whole point is that they don't want you to have a goal. They want says, don't you try to watch something. Let us tell you what to watch. And it's like, but what if I already know what I want to watch? It's like, no, sorry, that's wrong, user. You should not know what you want to watch. I know you think you want to watch the next episode on the show you've been watching for the past 30 days. All you've been doing every night is watching the show. And you probably want to watch the next episode, but there's no way in hell I'm going to show that to you.
Yeah, I could not
try and find it.
It's so bad. It's so bad. Anyway, all right, moving along. Michael McGuire writes, this is with regard to your Ask ATP segment about IDE updates. I think your focus on incremental updates of Xcode versus full downloads might have missed the point of the question. In almost every other development platform I've used, including Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, IntelliJ, and others, there's a separation between the SDK, the build system, and the editor itself. Take Android, for instance. The SDK is a direct download from Android Studio, which uses Gradle for building. Even the compiler is a separate component that can often be independently upgraded. With Apple, it's a big gelatinous blob. When you update Xcode, you are getting a new compiler, build system, SDK, and IDE. Other than simulators and Swift compiler toolchains, it is an all-or-nothing affair. And even with Swift, you can't use a compiler outside of the one shipping with Xcode if you are deploying to the App Store. I think that this is perhaps why the writer of the question is confused. From the outside, Apple's way of doing things is completely foreign. That's a pretty good summary, actually.
Yeah, I mean, but the explanation for that is pretty straightforward. Like, everyone who knows enough to ask this question knows why Apple does it. It's more convenient for them. It's you would say it's less convenient for users because you got to do this big download, but it has fewer permutations of stuff. If Apple lets you mix and match, like they used to let you mix and match more than they do, but if they let you mix and match, debugging problems for Apple and for developers would be more difficult because it's so much harder to describe your situation. Whereas at least now you can say, I'm using Xcode, whatever, whatever, right? And that description encapsulates the entirety of your situation. If you had to say, I'm using this compiler with this IDE, with this, you know, it's more variables, right? So they ship it all as one unit because it's just simpler for everybody involved. It is more limiting. You have less flexibility. That's true. But I kind of don't fault Apple for this because they have a fairly complicated thing. Xcode itself is a very complicated IDE. Their compiler toolchain is complicated. They target lots of different devices. I would not endorse the idea that Apple should, at this point, with their current quality standards and resourcing, break out their IDE from their toolchain, from their build system or whatever. Please continue to ship it as all one unit. Just make it work better.
And frankly, you know, as a developer, you know, with the disclaimer that my internet connection is good enough that the download sizes aren't prohibitive, I actually prefer it this way because I don't want to have to deal with, oh, this version of this tool is out of date, but this is conflicting with this thing over here. Like, you know what it would be like. We've seen this in other areas of tech. And with the
tell me you're a CocoaPods developer without yeah. telling me you're a CocoaPods developer. Holy smokes, it's so bad.
Right. Like, we know exactly what it would be a mess of, like, package installation and conflicts and dependencies and tools not working right with each other or things thinking they're there when they're not. Like, we know what that world would be like. I am very happy to have this one area of my life that I don't have to deal with that.
Yeah. William Vibrinskis writes, the Ford F-150 Lightning sunroof does kind of what you explained in the latest ATP. It's the full length of the roof, slightly tinted. It fully opens and has a cloth motorized cover. I am here for Marco driving a pickup. That I cannot imagine what that would look like.
I am shocked that something like this exists. Like, it really, I looked at a video, it really does all those things. It's just a unicorn. I don't know of any other vehicle in like the past two decades that had all these things. Glass sunroof with tint, with a cloth cover that also opens. It's unheard of.
Aaron's does. Aaron's, it's not the full length of the roof.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, in modern full glass roof thing, but that also is tinted, but that also opens, but that also has a cloth cover. Like, it's everything combined. It used to be the norm. Like, it's what you get in all of them back when sunroofs were these little rounded rec portals on the top of your car, but now it's the whole roof.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron's is the largest sunroof that I have had ownership of, but it is not nearly as big as a lot of these.
And it doesn't. There's glass between it and the windshield too, right? It's not continuous. Right?
Yes, yeah. There's metal between it. And
yeah,
the windshield.
I think that's true on the F-150 as well. It's just the Model X is the full glass thing.
Yeah, which, by the way, we made all the Model X owners mad and don't care.
You're saying it's more tinted than it is. It does look more tinted from the outside. That is true.
Yeah. We have a little bit of COVID follow-up. Let me just start with a disclaimer that if you are worried about getting advice regarding COVID, the last three humans on the planet you should listen to are the three of us. But
I wouldn't say that. No, we all have a lot of experience now.
Yeah. Well, that's true. We are
also, there's a lot of way worse advice out there.
Well, okay, that's also fair. I'm trying to be self-deprecating here, but no, you are right. That maybe
lot.
We're not the last.
Well, hey, yeah. let me preface this, because the reason this is important, the reason I put these links in here, when I talked about this last time, I said a bunch of stuff about COVID, and Mark was like, oh, I hadn't heard of that. Or one of you was like, oh, I hadn't heard of that. If you're not constantly keeping up with all the articles that come out about COVID and the various studies, like, stuff's changing all the time. So what I'd said about multiple COVID infections being subsequent COVID infections being worse, getting worse and worse instead of getting better. I wasn't just making that up. It was something that I had read. And then people said, oh, actually, you know, there have been more studies and they found out that's not really the case. Right. That's the way science works. Right. But I was like, is that really super outdated information? Because people ask for where did you read this? I'm like, oh, I've seen this recently enough. I can pull up the link and I would send it to people. And the study was like a Washington University study or something. November 2022. That's not that long ago.
No, it is
so
not.
So November 2022, it's like already outdated, right? Because yep. There so many people are studying this, as you can imagine. The status quo changes. And if you haven't looked at the status quo since like 2020 or 20, if you haven't like read up about COVID stuff since 2020 or 2021, so much has changed since then. So there's a whole class of people who I'd never heard that subsequent COVID infections get worse. I'd heard about it all over the place because for whatever reason, in my various news feeds and Twitter feeds and Mastodon feeds, I tend to see these articles. And there was a big hubbub made about this article in November 2022. And that's the last thing I had read about COVID that had stuck in my mind. And it wasn't that long ago. But since then, people have jumped on that and said, okay, well, we'll try to reproduce this study. Let's look at this study. Are there flaws in it or whatever? And so the upshot is that subsequent studies have found that they can't reproduce the results of this other one. And they're not sure it was, representative of average people. So research continues. But yep. This is just to drive home the point that it's hard to stay on top of the stuff because it is changing like month by month. Week by week. And even when there's a big story that's across all the big papers and everything, because there's Washington University study, you'll find it in every single big news site covered heavily. You have to look and see if they were. And of course, that story gets more coverage than the follow up that says, actually, we couldn't reproduce this. That's not as exciting a story, but it is out there. And, you know, and there'll be another one at like the recent round of things are like, what kind of things you're more susceptible to after you're infected with COVID. Oh, you know, 5 times higher chance of heart disease and 3 times higher chance of diabetes or whatever. And then the follow-ups to those are like, well, but is it give you more of a chance of diabetes? Are you now going to the doctor so you're more likely to be diagnosed with diabetes, whereas before you weren't going to the doctor because you were quarantining? And it's like, research continues. So it's hard to keep up with this treadmill, but I think it is, it's not important to be on the treadmill, but it's also not important to cement your idea of COVID in 2020 because so much has changed since then. It will continue to change.
Yep. So I really enjoyed Keith's feedback. I'm going to try to make this very quick. As further proof that your audience is extremely diverse, I'm a scientist, PhD medicinal chemist, who has worked on viruses for pretty much my whole career, first as a medicinal chemist and then in other roles. And, you know, Keith has worked on basically anything you've heard of in the past. Reinfection does not lead to increased severity. Most systematic studies have shown that disease severity is generally lower or similar on reinfection. There are tons of references out there, but there, and he cites two different studies, put them in the show notes. And then a more recent publication seems to confirm this and suggests that reinfection has a similar severity to the first infection, not worse. Related, COVID does not interfere with the immune system to make subsequent infections worse. This famously occurs with dengue and likely Zika through a mechanism called antibody-dependent enhancement. There's no evidence that this occurs with COVID. Selfishly, I thought this was fascinating. Keith had commented that if Michaela had been vaccinated in the last 3 months, which again, she was first week in January and we got sick, what, like 2-3 weeks ago? Then her antibody levels are likely to be high enough to prevent infection. And we tested her a handful of times and she was negative every time. And then John started, you know, sprinkling the links, which we'll put in the show notes, to this study that you were referring to just a moment ago, John. And in a subsequent email to me, Keith wrote, I would add that there's a study that seems to show worse outcomes on reinfection, which I think John may be referring to. This was a veteran study published late last year. Yep. And it did indeed get a lot of attention. It is a good paper and there are no obvious massive flaws. However, no other publication has shown this and most have shown the opposite. Plus, it somewhat flies in the face of basic immunology that the immune system learns what infects it so it, that it is prepared for future infections. The study has received some level of criticism that the study is based to older white males. Personally, I think there's something odd about the selection criteria, i.e. who goes into the control group and who doesn't, that makes me suspect that there's an underlying bias that screws things up. Or perhaps the study is correct and old white dudes are getting some payback. Which I thought was quite funny. So thank you to Keith. There was a lot more that Keith wrote that I, again, found utterly fascinating. But that's the TLDR, which I also thought was.
Yeah. And part of the people writing about and trying to study the idea of it messing with your immune system is the idea that if subsequent infections get worse and not better, that flies in the face of what you would expect. And it only happens in infections that do actually attack your immune system. And so I mentioned measles last time as other examples here. So that's why people study these things. And that's why, you know, when someone does a study, someone follows up on it and tries to figure out more. So, you know, every day, hopefully we're making progress. But I think it is worth occasionally dipping your toe back into the updated information on whatever your trusted source is. Probably not a newspaper, but, you know, the big health systems like the CDC in the US or whatever tend to take a while to get on board, as we saw during the initial wave of COVID. Maybe CDC's advice lagged behind the best thinking by a significant amount, and maybe as occasionally politically motivated, which is not great. But wherever you decide to check things out, it's a good idea to you know, occasionally check back in and see how things have changed.
Well, because also, you know, quote, COVID is not just one virus. Like, we've had so many variants that have become dominant at different times throughout this pandemic that, you know, whatever variant you get now, you know, you might have different responses to it because it's actually a different virus than the one you got 2 years ago. Like, it's not, this is not a you know, stationary target that we're talking about here. The virus is also evolving. Conditions are also changing. Treatments are changing. You know, people have or don't have vaccines and, you know, different timings on that, different vaccines they could have gotten, you know, different drugs they might have taken. You know, there's so many variables here. So, yeah, the way to stay on top of things like this is to be willing to change your mind when new information becomes available.
Yeah, a lot of the subsequent studies are on exactly that. They're like, well, we studied this and we're pretty happy that everyone was able to reproduce it and we understood it, but that was for like the original variant. So now we have to do all those same studies again with Delta, with Omicron, with like, because they're basically redoing stuff to confirm, hey, does this still apply with the current variant that's out now, right? Just like they had to do with like all this science they did about COVID before vaccines, they had to redo all that with vaccines. Says, how did the vaccines change? Did they affect it at all? And that's why, even if you think everything is, you know, settled down and it's understood, when new variants come out, they have to redo a lot of that stuff because they have to, at the very least, confirm, is this also true of whatever the popular variant is now? So it's tough.
Yeah. There are definitely worse people to get the advice from than the three of us. I don't know what I was thinking. This is the danger of speaking externally.
We will never tell you to take horse paste.
Yeah, right. I have regrets. All right, let's do some talk about Apple. Apparently it is the season, 'tis the season for iPhone leaks and rumors, but more leaks. And we have a report from 9to5Mac, two reports, actually, one about the iPhone 15 CAD drawings, which allegedly reveal a larger 6.2-inch display and a dynamic island and USB-C. And then separately, they also have an exclusive first look at the special edition color for the iPhone 15 Pro, which I believe is coral, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, there you go. They just need to pair it with orange and they'll be set. And not many of you understood that joke, but power to you if you did. Go Hokies. This stands to reason that the iPhone 15, the not Pro, is getting the dynamic island this year, getting a slightly larger display. USB-C is a surprise if that's real. But otherwise, yeah, this basically makes sense to me.
I think it is real because I feel like this is basically iPhone announcement day. You know, like iPhones just reliably leak. I think this is earlier than normal. But once the CAD drawings, as they always call them in these stories, like once that stuff comes out and it's close enough to the date and enough sort of people corroborate it and it starts appearing around, it might as well be the day of the iPhone announcement. We talk about future iPhones all the time on the show, and usually we're just covering the rumors. Here's what people think it might be. Here's what it could be. Here's what it means technology-wise, right? But at a certain point, all that coalesces to be, here's the new iPhone. And then when they announce the new iPhone, they're like, yep, that's exactly what we knew about, you know, however long ago. Yeah. And so if you look at these CAD drawings, it has eliminated a lot of the things that I was hoping for and confirmed some things that, you know, that I was expecting. So the USB-C on everything, you know, even though these are just CAD drawings, we know a USB-C hole when we see it, right? That's what this is. I think I've talked about it in the past, but my desire for less of a camera bump and my hope that the quote unquote periscope camera lens assembly on future iPhones would make this happen. This is not that year. The only place there's going to be a periscope camera is in the Pro Max, and they're not using it to make the bump smaller. They're just using it to get more zoom, right? These drawings, they look kind of like the existing iPhone 13 or 14 Pro, but with more rounded edges. So it's not the same case. It is, you know, it has more of a rounded edges, flat sides, but a little bit more of a rounded edge. And the Pros apparently have a titanium frame, which will be cool from a materials finish point of view, if that's even true. But otherwise, if you look at the CAD drawings, they look a lot like a 14 Pro. There's a massive three camera gigantic plateau with many, many levels. And the regular iPhone has just the two cameras with a smaller plateau. They have not radically changed the design. There's not a new camera hump. They're not slimmer in the camera area. They're just, you know, they're just new iPhones, which is not disappointing necessarily, but I mean, I guess it increases my odds because this is not my phone year. Next year is my phone year. I guess it increases my odds if that's going to happen. Maybe it'll happen the next year, but I don't know. I just kind of feel like we're stuck with this lump for a while, and it's kind of disappointing. But the titanium will be exciting. And the other thing in the story is, breaking down how it's going to be between Pro and non-Pro and how they're going to differentiate. They're already differentiating in this generation with the good SoC in the Pro and, like, quote-unquote, last year's SoC in the non-Pro. It seems like they're going to continue to do that, and this Max Tech video that we'll link in the show, it's had like a little slide that listed what they thought would be the Pro features to get you to pony up for the fancy one. ProMotion, I'm assuming that would be there. They list the screen sizes as well, but I assume those will be close. Apparently the Pro has a different size screen. The 15 Pro has a different size screen slightly than the 14 Pro, which whatever, it could just be the screen manufacturer. 2.5D glass, which is their way of saying kind of like on the Apple Watch, if you look at it from the side, the glass bulges out a little bit, which seems wild to me. And you can't really see in these CAD drawings because the CAD drawings are just of the case. Wouldn't you want the glass of your phone not to stick out past the edge? Cases do. But on the other hand, kind of like the watch glass, maybe it does that because it's thicker. But on the other hand, really thick glass would make your finger not feel like it's touching the things under the screen as well. So I don't know what to make of that, but I'm just reading out what's here. Thinner bezels, if you can even tell that without your, you know, calipers out. Titanium frame, solid state buttons, which we talked about in the past, which is wacky. Periscope lens on the Pro Max model. The A17, which the regular iPhone 15 won't have, presumably. 8 gigs of RAM, Wi-Fi 6E, and Thunderbolt 3. So the rumor is that the plain iPhone 15 has a USB-C shaped hole, but it is not Thunderbolt. And the rumor was that it's USB 2 speeds, which, I mean, I guess that would definitely be an Apple thing to do, right? Put a USB-C on the iPhone and not increase the transfer speed. But the rumor is that the Pro has a USB-C shaped hole that does Thunderbolt 3, which would be a welcome improvement. So that's actually a lot of advantages for the Pro, mostly achieved by making the non-Pro crappier, I guess. But Anyway, if you're wondering where the iPhone 15 is going to be, at this point, I feel pretty confident saying that if you follow this link in 9to5 Mac and look at the pictures, the only things you don't know are the things nobody ever knows. What are they going to call the color? What are the new colors going to be? What are the new finishes going to be? What are the exact prices going to be? All that stuff like basically doesn't leak because you don't need thousands and thousands of people to know it. But because you need to manufacture so many of these things, and because they're probably going to start manufacturing them soon, this stuff can and will leak. And so we'll, you know, when we watch these iPhone keynotes, it's like the only thing we're finding out is like, seeing the Apple promo videos and seeing what they're going to call that coral color.
This makes me very, very happy overall, because here's the thing, all the things that we don't know, and there's so many, every year there's usually some like new camera feature that the new hardware enables that's only available on the newest phone. And so, there's going to be some cool camera feature. We don't know the details about the cameras really to any degree of credibility. How good is the, if they're going to do a periscope thing, how good is that going to be for the optical zoom or whatever? How zoomed in is it going to be? How compromised is that camera going to be, relative to the 1X camera? There's so many details like that. But for me, they had me at USB-C. They could change nothing else. They could make it just switch to USB-C charging, and I'd be like sold, and I'd buy it instantly. I mean, and to me, the two things I'm most excited about are USB-C, number one, by a mile, and then a distant number two, titanium. Because ultimately, I'm pretty happy with my, 14? With my 14 Pro. except it's really freaking heavy. And it's not like a deal breaker. I do wish it was smaller, but I really wish it was lighter. And it's pretty hard to make a modern smartphone lighter without giving up a lot of battery life, because batteries are pretty heavy. And one of the ways they can do it is they can switch from steel for the outer rim, which there is no reason to have that. They can switch to a lighter metal, and titanium is a great option. And that was like, we see these renders here, but remember a few days ago, somebody actually posted like a leaked alleged photo of the case.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I saw that photo, and I saw the kind of horizontal grained brushed finish, and I was like, titanium! I yelled it. Like, it's I was so happy. I'm like, that, you could tell instantly by looking at that, that's almost certainly titanium. And I was so happy to see that.
I do wonder if that's an unfinished model. You know what I mean, though. Like,
yeah,
like,
yeah, we don't.
They haven't put the finish on it.
Yeah, but it sure. I mean, it looked like brushed finish of titanium.
Yeah, and I kind of wish they would. Finished. I wish they would sell one that looked like that. Like the look would be brushed unfinished titanium, but I have a feeling they're not going to.
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, I can't even tell you what the outside of mine looks like because it's in a case all the time because these are too big to hold.
I know. You just want it to be lighter. Like, and it's even if you look at the titanium watches, they have also not been looked like unfinished titanium. They've always kind of had a uniform matte kind of thing going on. I'm not sure what that finish is, but
it's interesting. The Ultra, which is titanium, basically has like a uniform sandblasted look to it.
Yeah, there, it's like
pebbly. There's no grain on the Ultra, whereas the previous series up to 7 editions that were titanium have vertical or horizontal graining on, and it looks really nice. This is, I mean, I still, my daily driver Apple Watch is still a Series 7 because I like titanium so much, and they took it away with the Series 8. Again, I really hope they bring this back with the Series 9. That's like my one wish for the Apple Watch Series 9. My biggest wish is bring back titanium, and then my second biggest wishes are things like make the software better. But that's a different story for a different day. But yeah, so iPhone 15 rumors, thumbs up for me so far.
Yeah, I don't have a dire need for USB-C in terms of travel, which I think is when most people would be interested in it, because I do love my little docking base thing that I talked about many moons ago. But I will tell you that we have a single USB-C Apple charging cable strung from the wall through the couch, so it's basically available to whoever's sitting on the couch at the time. And what's great about that is it can charge Aaron's computer. It can charge my computer. It can charge the kid iPad. It can charge my iPad. But you know what it can't friggin' charge? My stupid phone. I would love it. I mean, I would love to have Thunderbolt in a Pro phone, but even leaving that aside, and I think this is what you were saying a minute ago, Marco, like, just give me the connector. Like, I don't even care if it's USB 2 speeds for the most part. Just give me the damn connector. And so I can sit on the couch and use the cable that's right there and actually charge the phone. Yes, please. I'll take two. I can only hope. All right. Anything more about that before we move on? Go team. There was a very interesting release from Mark Gurman this week. Gurman says that Apple has made major progress on a no-prick blood glucose tracking for its watch. Apple Inc. has a moonshot-style project underway that dates back to the Steve Jobs era, non-invasive and continuous blood glucose monitoring. The goal of this secret endeavor, dubbed E5, is to measure how much glucose is in somebody's body without needing to prick the skin for blood. After hitting major milestones recently, the company now believes it could eventually bring glucose monitoring to market, according to people familiar with the effort. I'll be the first to tell you I don't know very much about all of this, but my limited understanding is, and please, one of you jump in whenever you're ready, is that for those of us who are diabetic, you need to know what the status of your blood glucose is. And to do that is a kind of a pain. And there are these continuous monitors that you can get, but I guess they're very complicated and they don't work very well. And then people will like hack them. What's the guy from Microsoft whose name is escaping me right now that's done a lot of this?
Paul Allen?
He's dead. No.
Yeah, Paul Allen's dead, right?
Is he? No, I didn't think he was.
Now I gotta look.
Now we gotta derail everything and look. the programmer guy. Yes, he died in 2018.
He died in 2018, yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I think he had cancer or something.
Oh, that's too bad.
Anyways, no, the developer guy. Oh, gosh, I'm so mad that I can't think of his name.
Raymond Chen?
No. The popular developer guy that like does all that's been podcasting since way before we have.
Joel Spolsky?
No, God bless it. I can't think of the damn guy's name. He wrote a lot of .NET back in the day. Casey List said somebody in the chat. Well done.
Handsome?
Oh, God. Yes, thank you. Handsome. That's who I'm thinking of.
I would not have pegged him as the Microsoft guy. All right. Okay.
Well, he is at Microsoft.
I know. I get it. Yeah, you're right. He's a guy at Microsoft.
Anyway, this is going right off the rails, and I'm pretty sure it's my fault, and I'm not the sick one. But anyways, I believe that he is diabetic or something along those lines, and has done a lot of stuff with regard to continuous blood glucose monitoring. And I guess there's like a whole hobby, not even industry, but like a grassroots thing where people will, you know, figure out how to hack like existing blood glucose monitors to make them work way better and something like that. All of that is to say, my very, very limited, mostly ignorant understanding is this is a big frickin' deal. And I can only imagine how amazing this would be if I were diabetic to have something like this.
Well, the good news is you're now 40% more likely to be diabetic.
Why? Because COVID?
Yeah. This is a March 31st, 2022 story. So I'm sure it's changed since then. But anyway, lots of people. Again, it's the question, as I was saying before. So they do these studies and it says, you know, people who had COVID-19 were 40% more likely to develop diabetes up to a year later. But then it's like, okay, but is that just because they went to the doctor? Right. Because they're getting diagnosed because they made a trip they wouldn't have normally taken to the doctor. And so now it's discovered and it would have been there anyway. So it's hard to tell. I'm just making a joke. But anyway, I think the correct stat is like 10% of the U.S. adult population is diabetic or something. It's not a rare condition, which is why this story, which, by the way, as the Gurman article notes, this project has been known outside of Apple as a rumor, of course, because Apple isn't confirming any of this stuff for just a long, long time. And it's kind of like saying, yeah, we're working on perpetual motion or, you know, cold fusion or whatever. It's a thing that if you were to find a way to do it, it is a big moneymaker. And also it would have a big effect on people's lives. Doesn't sound like it's a big deal. It's like, oh, what's the big deal? You prick your finger, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Imagine if you had to do that every day, sometimes multiple times a day to like plan out your eating. It is painful and annoying and inconvenient, and it really messes with people's lives, and it affects millions and millions of people. So if you can find a non-invasive way to do that, you can make a lot of people's lives better, which means you can also make a lot of money. And there's those things they have now that you sort of slap onto your skin that look like little stickers, but they have little things that poke into your skin, and they're not painful, but they hook up to some other meter. Like, everyone's always trying to crack this nut because there's a huge addressable market. It is a big problem. And current solutions are seemingly barbaric. I mean, pricking your finger with a piece of metal and putting a drop of blood onto a strip of paper is, you know, Stone Age technology from a medical perspective. So if your Apple Watch could just tell you, boy, wouldn't that be amazing? Kind of like if you had a car that could drive itself while you sleep at the wheel. Wouldn't that be amazing? That would be amazing. But also really hard to do. So the fact that Apple is trying to tackle this, I mean, at first it probably kind of seemed like, all right. I mean, I get it. That would make the world a better place. It would make Apple a lot of money. It's the intersection of liberal arts and technology, the intersection of altruism and capitalism, whatever you want to call it. Kind of makes sense. But why does Apple have to do this? Apple's not a healthcare company, right? But on the other hand, as technology advances, this problem, like the way you're trying to solve this problem, is like, okay, well, we need a bunch of sensors that are attached to your body with a microprocessor to interpret the results, because it's not straightforward. Like, it's not like, oh, we'll just, you know, take this measurement, and if it's above this value, it's your, you know, it's complicated. It's the, like the technology they're talking about in the rumors is they fire a bunch of tiny lasers into your skin and everything, and look at the scatter back and analyze it with this complicated, like, you need a little computer. And if the idea is you need to have sensors attached to your skin with a powerful little computer that people are willing to wear, suddenly you're like, Apple seems actually a pretty good fit for this. So if Apple can ever figure it out, they're as well positioned as anybody to solve this problem in a way that, as they would say, synergizes with their business. They're already selling Apple Watches. Apple Watches' primary purpose is already mostly for fitness and health-related things. Lots of people have this health problem. Being able to sell them an Apple Watch that would solve this problem, boy, they would sell so many Apple Watches. The one bad thing that Apple probably doesn't anticipate is that if they actually solve this problem, there will be immediate pressure for them to sell Apple Watches for less money, because it is unfair to sort of keep this technology. You know, it's like, oh, it's Apple patented and no one else can implement it and blah, 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 which is terrible and all. And the cheapest Apple Watch that has this feature is like $400. I mean, people will still pay it because, you know, they'll pay, like, they'll find a way to pay it because it's such a quality of life increase. But it cheaper almost seems, yeah, well, yeah, it almost seems ridiculous and unfair that that something that could improve so many people's lives is, you know, under the control of a private company that, for reasons unrelated to evil but just related to their market positioning, doesn't sort of serve down market. And even when, you know, you mentioned the insulin thing, like, what was it, the person who made the insulin discovery or got the patent for it or whatever intended it to be available for everybody and never wanted it to be expensive. But that person died, and the rest of the people took that ball and ran with it. And now insulin costs $1 bazillion in the U.S. because people found out that other people needed to live, and you can charge them a lot of money, which is why healthcare should not be a for-profit enterprise. Anyway, I guess this is good to hear. Oh, progress is being made. But at this point, this is like the original Project Titan. Like, at this point, when I hear stories about the blood glucose thing, I'm like, okay, well, you know, when you figure it out, let me know. I'll just wait another decade here, because if it's going on for so long, and so far we've got pretty much nothing to show for it. Like, Apple does health stuff and, you know, blood pressure and ECG or whatever. Like, they do all these health things, but not once has there been a whiff of blood glucose anything from Apple. So obviously they haven't figured it out yet. So I'm rooting for them, but I really, you know, I don't think it's a story until it's a story. And until then, it is a very long-running money pit for Apple that I think honestly has more promise than Project Titan at this point.
Oh, but
it's also been running longer than Project Titan without results, so I don't know.
I mean, the thing is, like, other companies make cars and they're pretty good, which we'll get to a little bit later. And so, like, you know, it's fun. Like, we don't need Apple to make a car. No one has done this. And you know, as you're right, like, this is a... If they can pull this off, it's a massive deal. Like, and so that's why I think hearing even a rumor from Mark Gurman that this might have made major progress and that this might be able to become a product at some point in the future, like, hearing news about this, it's not quite on the same level, but it's I think it's a similar kind of moonshot as fusion. It's like, oh my God, like, when you hear news that like we've made progress, as we actually recently have made progress in the area of sustainable fusion energy, like, that's the kind of moonshot this is. It's like, this is like, you know,
that would be curing diabetes. I think we categorize that, not just funny, a better way to deal with it. Curing it would be more of that type curing cancer. By the way, so we don't get all the follow up on that, the progress on fusion, the fusion naysayers are going to write it and tell us that it's not as close as you think, because that's the way fusion works.
I didn't say it was close, but I said they made progress, which is true.
It's hard to tell when you're so far from the finish line.
I know. But, you know, the point is, like, people care a lot even when small progress is made, because if we ever pull it off, it's such a big deal. That's how this is. Like, any news on this front is a big deal, because if this thing ever actually is workable as a real product, that's a huge deal. Like, you know, none of us have diabetes, but my dog does. And I actually have used on him one of those continuous monitor things. And, you know, you mentioned, oh, yeah, it doesn't hurt. Well, it is.
Dogs don't understand, though. You can't explain to them.
I know. But, like, it, you know, so here's the thing, like, What you're trying to sample, and please, actual diabetics out there, I apologize for if any of these details are wrong. I only know it through my dog. But what you're trying to sample is you're trying to figure out the curve of your blood glucose level over time. And, you know, when you eat, that goes up and then it comes down over time as the effect of insulin comes in and everything. And so when you just, you know, prick your finger and get a little sample there, you're sampling one point on a wave. And, you know, you might not necessarily know where on that wave you are. So while the point sampling has, you know, clear value over no information, continuous data is far more useful. Way, way, way more useful. Way more actionable, way more precise. And in fact, I'm pretty sure, I don't know the details of this, so forgive me, but I know that the like diabetic human world has long since largely moved to insulin pumps, which kind of monitor stuff continuously and give you the right amount of insulin at any given time, is how I understand it. But, you know, instead of just like one big shot, whereas I have to give my dog just, you know, two big shots a day. But anyway, because they don't have those for dogs, and he's really small anyway, so it wouldn't even fit him. But anyway, and yes, it's horrible giving your dog insulin shots. It's heartbreaking. They let you do it because they let you do anything, but God, it's heartbreaking for you because you can't tell them why you're hurting them. And oh God, I can't give them the carrot fast enough. I just, oh God. Anyway, so it breaks my heart. But anyway, but so when we were first figuring out his diabetes, we had one of those continuous monitor things, and it's basically, it looks like, it's like the size of like maybe like $2 half-dollar coins stacked on each other, but it has about a half-inch needle pointing straight out the back. It's like sticking a thumbtack into your arm, like, and it sits there and it stays there for like a week, and then after a while, you know, you gotta like change it and, you know, put a new one on, and like they have these things for humans. It's the exact same product for dogs. I forget what it's called, but it's the exact same product, And it's this Bluetooth thing. I was able to go on the app and see see his blood insulin or his blood glucose curve and see, okay, well, here's where he's peaking roughly. So we'll give him the insulin here. We'll measure it and we'll see, you know, over time how it does. And here's how it's going to work. Here's when we need it, you know, all that stuff. So for diabetics, continuous monitoring is hugely valuable. And if you can do it on a device that you're already buying, or that you might be buying for a combination of other reasons. Maybe you're buying it for fitness notifications, you know, whatever it is you're buying an Apple Watch, you already have it, then it's there. And then additionally, there's a huge amount of value for non-diabetics who would never have a reason to get a prescription for the thing that you stick on your arm and have continuous monitoring. Like, you know, I personally would never, why would I get one of those? I'm not diabetic, so I don't have any reason to get one of those and to stick it on my arm and have this, you know, needle sticking in my arm for a week. But there is huge value in knowing those levels if you're doing things like paying attention to your nutrition, or maybe trying to avoid, you know, getting type 2 diabetes in the future. If you're like kind of on, you know, at risk for that, if you're kind of on the border, you can start making changes. You can see what you have to do. You can maybe see like, hey, you know what? After I have this one kind of breakfast, my glucose spikes really high. Maybe I should think about changing that diet. You know, you can. There is so much value there. In the same way that right now the Apple Watch will, you know, there are settings that I believe that are on by default, where if you're in a super loud environment, it will tell you, hey, this is, you're above 90 decibels for the last minute. This could really hurt your hearing if you do this all the time. And everyday people can get that and see, huh, that's interesting. Maybe I shouldn't, you know, put my desk right next to this jet engine. In the same way, maybe they could have a future feature where if you have some massive sugar bomb meal and your blood glucose spikes way too high, maybe it could tap you in the wrist and say, hey, your blood sugar is really high right now. Like, you know, maybe consider, you know, having some fiber or something, you know. And so even if you can think, not only would this be life-changing to diabetics, probably, but even just for everyone in the world, they could build other health-conscious features around it. And so there is just – there, and not to mention the fact that even people, you know, people who aren't paying attention can get kind of alerts in extreme cases like that. But people who are paying attention, like – I would love that because I care a lot about diet and fitness these days. And so I would love to know, like, to like set goals, to be like, you know what, I want to make sure I'm not exceeding this range of glucose levels in my day-to-day life. And maybe I would like to get an alert if I ever do, so I can make changes just for my own, you know, the same people track their sleep and stuff. I want to be able to track, you know, that kind of health as well. So there are huge possible features and benefits to this kind of thing if they can get it going. You know, a huge part of the Apple Watch is taking something that used to be a specialized medical thing, you know, like the EKG, for instance, taking something like that and bring it to a device that a lot of people are going to just have for other reasons anyway. And then if they have a weird, you know, heart arrhythmia or something, their watch can tell them, hey, something's a little bit off. And that is such massive value. So, you know, you have the massive value for the people who have certain conditions, like the AFib detection is huge. If you know anybody who has AFib, or if you have AFib, you know, having the Apple Watch be able to track that and tell you when you're in AFib is a pretty big deal. But also it's a big deal for a whole bunch of other people who don't know that this might be a problem for them. And then if it starts becoming a problem for them, like one of the things I figured out weirdly is that I know that this is going to sound really crazy and stupid, but I've had COVID twice, I think. And both times I had COVID, the day before I tested positive, there was a point in the day where the Apple Watch, and I was feeling crappy, and the Apple Watch gave me that alert that says, hey, your heart rate's a little bit high, and you don't seem to be doing anything. Both times I had COVID, that happened to me the day before I tested positive. And I've never got that alert any other time. So it is telling me, hey, your body's, something's wrong. Like something, like that kind of alert, that helps. That is actionable for people. That really has a pretty big benefit to people, even who don't have whatever kind of certain conditions might have them get some kind of medical device in the first place. So again, this is amazing for diabetics, but it is not just limited to diabetics in benefit. This could have huge benefits to everyone.
Especially hypochondriacs, they love it. Yeah, that's the dark side of all these things. Of sometimes, as Merlin said, having more data is not helpful, especially with people who, you know, find it kind of an attractive nuisance. But in general, it's a net win to know this stuff. In particular, especially if our healthcare system wasn't barbaric, and this could, for example, funnel into your doctor, who is probably more qualified to know, you know, if this is normal for your age and activity for you, or if there's something to be concerned about. You know what I mean? So be great if that could be tied in for them, not to just ask you how you've been feeling or to like look at your most recent measurements, but to just like, if you're doing continuous monitoring, it would be great if they could just see that graph over the past 30 days and say, yeah, looks like you might be a diabetic, or no, actually you're fine. Don't worry about this. Don't freak out when you see this number, because for your age and what you ate at that meal, this is actually fine. And it's not a thing to be worried about, because they know whether it's something to be worried about or not. Whereas you're just looking at a number saying, that seems high. I Googled and the number shouldn't be that high. Maybe I'm dying. So it's tricky. So don't get too hung up on that. But the difficult thing with the glucose monitoring, I feel like, is, well, it's not difficult for them, but like when you see the story, it seems like what they're going for is the brass ring of like continuous monitoring that you can use instead of pricking your finger, right? That's what people want. You know, no more patch, no more finger pricks, just an Apple, non-invasive Apple Watch, the holy grail. But for all the other stuff they've done, like AFib detection and stuff, they're really cautious. They're like, well,
you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to bring this up as well.
If something's really out of whack, we'll be like, hey, we think this is probably not great. But that's not what you want from glucose monitoring. I mean, it's better than nothing. That's what I'm saying. It's better than nothing. They don't have to get the brass ring. If it just tells you, oh, you might have missed a shot or something, and things are really bad, and it alerts you, that is useful. But you really don't want that to be the only functionality. You want to be able to have the watch let you know what you would find out from doing your testing, or whether continuous monitoring with a patch or pricking your finger or whatever, so you don't get into the bad situations. That's what you want. You want to avoid the extremes. But with the health measurement stuff, Apple's been so cautious because it's really difficult to be sure. And with something like this, where someone is making essentially a life or death decision about whether and how much insulin they should take, it's not like, oh, if I get it wrong, nothing bad will happen. No, bad things can happen. And if the pitch is kind of like self-driving cars, if the pitch is this car will drive itself and you can go to sleep, that boy, that better be true. Because the consequences, if it's not, are really bad. And so if they say, oh, no, you don't need to measure with anything else except for the Apple Watch, they better really have solved that problem. You know, and again, that doesn't necessarily have to be the pitch. They could say, now we have glucose monitoring the Apple Watch, and it will give you an alert if things are way out of bounds, but you still have to test normally, but it's just an insurance mechanism. That's still useful. Still give that a thumbs up. But when these stories come out, it's people dreaming that they won't have to do whatever uncomfortable thing they're doing now. And crossing the bar for that is, it's really high. Like, because you have to really be sure. It is literally life and death for millions of people. It can't be guesswork. And if your watch crashes, there are big consequences. And if it gets it wrong, there are big consequences. And I don't know how they're going to handle it. Kind of like the car. It's one of those type of things where in general, Apple doesn't have products where if they get it wrong, like people die in short order. That's true of the car. And that's kind of true of complete replacement glucose monitoring, if that is indeed what they're going after.
Yeah, I was thinking about, and then you brought it up, you know, when they did the EKG thing, they were very quick to say, this is just a hint, you know, and when they did the ovulation tracking and prediction and whatnot, we're just giving you something else to think about, you know, you should still do your own thing, just something to consider. And, you know, when they, with the AFib stuff, you know, it's, we don't know if you're having a heart attack. We don't know that. We just know we have an idea about AFib, and they pump the brakes on like everything, which makes sense. Like I don't begrudge them having pumped the brakes, but yeah, this is, like you said, it is do or die, literally. So they can't pump the brakes on this if they are trying to get that brass ring, as you referred to it. And I don't know. I'm not sure how they're going to handle this. And if I were diabetic, I was going to say, I don't know if I would trust an Apple Watch this, but I would imagine I'd be so miserable with what I had been doing for years and years that anything would be like a cold glass of water in hell, right?
So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Even if it doesn't solve the problem entirely, if you just have to have like one fewer prick per day or three fewer per week, still that's an improvement. It's just a question of what are they actually able to achieve. I have no doubt that they will not, you know, they're only going to announce what they can actually achieve. They're not going to overpromise like some other people you may be familiar with related to self-driving cars. Whatever they can do, they will really. They've been so conservative, right? They've been so sort of underselling what they've done. So if they're not able to solve the whole problem, I have full faith that they will not claim to have solved the whole problem. They just say, here's what it can do, here's what it can't do. It can improve your life, but you're still going to have to use the other more invasive methods to supplement your Apple Watch. It will just maybe help you skip some of those or increase the granularity of the sampling or whatever. Like it, you know, any improvement is good, but the story is always so simplified in its rumor form, which is like, they're going to solve it. And, you know, it's great to think that before they actually announce anything. But as the story notes, this story is so old that it was around when Steve Jobs was still running the company. So,
right. Oh, blood oxygen was the other thing I couldn't think of a second ago. Blood oxygen. They were also like, we're not telling you if you have COVID or not. We're just letting you know.
Yeah, these numbers may not be, you know, accurate, but like if they're really out of whack, we might say, hey, you know, maybe look into this.
Yep.
And blood oxygen, like the official thing they use that in hospitals, is very similar to an Apple Watch. So it's not even that like they're far from, like, that is not new technology. Shining a light through your skin, as long as your skin is white, shining a light through your skin and getting a blood oxygenation measurement is long established technology. And even on that, they're like, well, we do have a light and we do shine it into your skin, but we're not going to make lots of promises because it is your wrist and not your fingertip and yada yada.
Hi, future Marco.
Hey.
I am of the opinion we skip Ask ATP and we do one or both of the potential after shows. If John, if you're feeling like shit, we can do just one, or if we just want to do a shorter show, how do the two of you feel?
I will vote for a single after show, please.
Okay, that's fine. All right, let's say goodbye then, Marco, and pretend I never said anything, and we'll do your after show, which I'm so excited for.
I might want. Should we do the Adam thing first as like a topic?
We can. How long do you think you need for that?
10 minutes, maybe.
I want to give the Adam thing a long period of time, and I want to not be sick during it. So do your Rivian thing.
Okay.
All right. Thank our sponsors, and we'll do some after show.
All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Memberful and the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. We will talk to you next week.
So I see something fascinating in the show notes for the after show. It reads as follows. Marco drove a Rivian.
Well, why would he need to do that? He's already got a perfectly good vehicle for driving on the sand. Why would he ever even look at another one? It performs beautifully. It solves his problem entirely. He even gave this car a watch.
So, are we really going there? I was gonna be gentle on you, Marco, but I am here for laughing about the poorly constructed British car, if that's what we want to
Well,
do.
I would love to know the order of events. Did the car rebel when it heard you were straying, or did you stray when it rebelled?
That car rebelled on the way to drive the Rivian.
Oh, it knows. It's like when you take your dog to the vet. It knows.
It knew.
But I will say, so there's a few relevant details here. First, what happened the day before was I sold the Tesla.
Oh, you didn't tell us this. This is genuinely new news. I'm not
yes,
just putting on a
I was
act
saving
here.
It for the show.
Oh, this is news. Oh, who or what did you sell it to?
So, as you know, I've been looking to try to get like, you know, somebody to buy it. I just wanted to do some kind of trade in thing. I didn't want to go through like eBay or Cars and Bids or anything, because like I'm hardly ever there where this car is, and I didn't, you know, it's winter. I don't want to like go get it clean.
You're perfectly timing this sale for the peak of the used Tesla market. Oh, not exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so anyway. And what kept killing the value of the car, so whenever you go online, you fill out a form of like, give me a quote for this car. What would kill it is that officially in whatever database they're looking at, it has an accident report. Because, and I think I said this on the show when it happened a couple years ago, it got scraped by a plow in the ferry parking lot.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it blew the tire up and everything. So
while it was parked.
Yes, I wasn't even there. It was parked. It got hit. It got scraped like on the front bumper panel or whatever. So it was bad enough that like a body shop had to replace the bumper, and I went through insurance because it would have cost like $6,000 because of the way Teslas are made. anyway, went through insurance. Cool. And apparently that got reported as, quote, an accident. And so, but there were no details in these databases of what this accident was. So whenever I'd fill out a thing, I'd be like, all right, you know, model year, model mileage. And it would tell me, okay, it's worth this. But then once it got down to like, all right, give us your license plate or VIN so we can give you like a firm offer on your particular car, it would go down like 10 grand because of that stupid accident report. And so anyway, so I was at my wit's end, and I was going like, I'm fine. I'm just going to – let me just see. A few people said, try CarMax. And I hadn't tried CarMax before because they for certain cars, they won't give you a quote online. It basically says, like, your car is too rare or finicky in the market value, so you need to bring it to our store, and we'll give you a quote in person. So I was like, I don't want to deal with that. But I was at my wit's end, so I'm like, you know what? Let me go see what they have to say, because I don't want to deal with this anymore. I'm tired of having three cars. It's a pain in the butt. This car is decreasing in value every day I don't sell it. And the last thing I want is to be sitting on this any longer than I have to. So it's already gone down enough since last fall. Like, so it's, I want to sell it, right? Anyway, so I drove all the way to the nearest one, which was in New Jersey. I'm like, you know, it's an hour away. I'm like, oh, I'm going to drive an hour for this, but let me just see. And honestly, I was a little sad to sell the Tesla because I loved that car. But as I was driving there, my back's all hurting, and I'm like trying to get the seat in like the right spot so it doesn't like, you know, irritate like sciatic stuff. And I'm like, man, okay. I'm like, I can't like, and that, since I've been away from this car for so long, I can't get comfortable in it now. Like, first, and I'm sitting, you know, on the ground, and everyone's all higher than me, and I'm like, you know, like I'm ready to get rid of it now. Plus, it is, you know, driving around a big red MAGA hat. So anyway, so I get there, and I'm like kind of saying goodbye to the car on the way there. You know, we've had our good times. You know, I love my cars, not all of them, but many of them. I love my cars. But yeah, the comfort thing, it was time. And it took forever. You know, you go in there, and everyone there is very nice, but it's like, oh, we're behind. It's going to be like a 45-minute wait before you even see somebody. Then you sit down with somebody at like, you know, what, it basically looks like a car dealership in there. It's like, you know, a bunch of sales desks, and you sit down with somebody, and it takes forever to go through all the different steps in the computer. And they're very nice about it, but it's just a very slow process. I think I was there for like 2.5 hours before they even told me a number, but I eventually got a number there. I was on the way there. I was like telling myself in my head, all right, I'm hoping to get this here. Here's the, like, you know, Kelley Blue Book dealer trade in value. Then here's what I would accept below that. Like, you know, another big chunk below that, here's the minimum I would accept.
Yep.
And this, I told myself, way, I'm like, even though I've driven there, and I'm going to be tempted to just, even if they lowball me, I'm going to be tempted to take it just because I've driven so far and it's been so long, but I'm like, I'm not going to take anything below this number. I tell myself before I get there, right? So, go through the whole thing, and sure enough, they're like, well, here's what we're basing the offer on, here's all these, check, all these different lists, and then here's, it says there's an accident, and I explained to the guy, like, what that was, but I don't think there's any, like, human input, really. I think it seemed like it was all algorithmic, like, and then take it or leave it. Like, it didn't seem like there was a lot of negotiation or human adjustment happening there.
Oh, there is, but keep going.
Oh, there is? Well, that's good to know, but Anyway,
because I have experience with this because the BMW almost got sold to CarMax. And by the way, CarMax based in Richmond, and I actually did a little work for them a couple of jobs ago. So I am more familiar than you would expect with how CarMax works.
Yeah, you're the reason I originally heard about it. But anyway, so the offer came back and it was right in the middle of what I wanted. Like, it was
nice.
It was about 10% less than the Blue Book trade-in value. And I was like, and I a recent Model S recently sold on Cars and Bids that had very similar specs, very similar year, very similar mileage, Model S, unlimited supercharging, all that stuff. And it was very slightly below what that sold for.
Nice.
So I was like, sold. I'm like, it's yours. Take it.
Give me the check right now. Yeah. And I am sprinting out of here.
And that's basically what happened. It was great. So I can honestly say I had a pretty good experience with CarMax. It did take forever, but everybody was very nice. And the offer was good. And it was way higher. I would say it was probably maybe 20% higher than anything else I got from anybody else, any other offer.
That's awesome.
Did you take two cars there? Is that how you dropped off the car and then you got driven back and someone else?
No, I took a Lyft back.
An hour? Oh, that must be
You're really cutting into the sale price of your car.
Right?
It was like $60. It was not that bad. I mean, you know, considering...
That's actually much less than I thought.
Yeah. So anyway, that was easy. That was fine. You know, it was New Jersey. That was the hardest part. You know, I had to turn left and that's the whole thing. But, you know, we figured it out.
So. Good thing you didn't have to pump your own gas, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Jersey.
So anyway, the following morning...
Well, congratulations. Congratulations. That's exciting.
Thank you. The following morning, a friend of mine has had for a while a Rivian R1T, the truck Rivian. And he had offered months ago, hey, if you ever want to come by, see a test drive it, let me know. And I was in town, so I'm like, hey, you know what? I'll take you up on that.
I would like to do that. Yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I work out the scheduling. I go see him, and he lives pretty close to me over there. So I had to drive, but it was ice raining, so I drove instead of walking. And I get in the Land Rover, you know, to drive a small distance away in the ice rain, and as I'm pulling out of my driveway, the dashboard lights up with a whole lot of lights, and the car is like losing power. It's like it was shifted into neutral. And I'm like, oh, no. What happened? What the heck is going on? And it's, you know, all the lights in the dashboard are on, like all the error lights. Everything's warning, like something's wrong.
Did the British national anthem start playing?
God save the king.
I can't even name the song. The joke would have been better if I knew more about the UK.
God save the king.
Sorry,
right?
Brits. There you go.
Whatever.
For our purposes, it doesn't matter. So anyway, so I'm like, what do I do here? And I noticed one of the lights that was lit was the battery light. And I happened to have plugged in to one of the little 12-volt ports, one of those like big rechargeable lithium batteries, like the kind that has a built-in AC inverter, and it's from this company. I'm not even going to name them. I bought one of these months ago for multiple reasons, you know, backup power and stuff like that, I got a small one so that could go in the car, and that way Adam could use his gaming PC on long car trips, because it needs like 200 watts or whatever. Anyway, so I had this battery, and this, I'm not going to name the company because it's a terrible battery. It is very buggy. It was supposed to have like USB-C in and out, and it's the buggiest thing I've ever used in that way. Like, it's so hard to get it charged via USB or to charge via USB. It is so hard. It's incredibly unreliable. I have no faith in the reliability of this battery. And I should have gotten a Jackery. I know this is a ridiculous sounding name. That's the good brand, and I had one of those in the past. And it got water damage at some point, and so I don't have it anymore.
Oh, you don't say.
That's a whole story. It was indoors, okay? It was it was
by an like actually
it was
indoors?
In the water closet, yeah.
Yeah, right. Actually indoors or indoors-ish?
It was in the basement water closet, where the water main comes up from the sand and goes into my house.
Many rooms in Marco's house are semi-aquatic.
Yeah, well, so it was sitting on sand, running some heat trace on a pipe so it wouldn't freeze over Christmas when we had that massive cold spell, but we were leaving for a few days. So I hook up this backup battery so that in case we had a big power outage, our water main would have something like 18 hours of backup power before it could potentially freeze. And there was a huge... The way that massive Christmas storm came through here was first as a whole bunch of rain. And fortunately, we didn't get the ice. But we were gone. All that rain happened. This backup power thing is sitting in a boxed-in, insulated closet where the floor of it is sand. And enough water came up through the sand during that, which this has never happened. Like, our house is not near sea level. Like, this has never happened. It came up through the sand enough to have at least a few inches of water to the point where when I got home, I pick up this battery and I hear whoosh, whoosh, and I'm like, oh, no.
That's not good.
That's not, and then
batteries do not like to have salt water inside them in general.
No, I pick it up and I tilted it, and all this water just pours out.
That's very bad.
Like, oh no!
If that happens with your car, also bad.
Yes.
If you ever tilt your car and salt water comes out?
Not good.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's how I lost my Jackery, and I should have bought another one, but instead I tried this other brand that was all like USA, and it's terrible. Anyway, so I had this other brand's battery plugged in charging to my car. And as I am driving, I'm getting all this, what appears to be, you know, power loss. The engine is cutting off, like, everything. Like, so I don't know enough about gas-powered cars to know, but, like, if there's too much draw on the alternator, is it possible that the engine actually stops because it can't, like, make sparks? Is that a thing?
What are you talking about? Like, you're saying if your battery's dead, it could undervolt all the electronics, which could screw with your engine.
Yeah, so my theory of what happened is that this crappy battery that I had plugged in that was charging through the cigarette lighter kind of plug, maybe it was pulling too much power, although wouldn't the fuse have tripped? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't think... I mean, the only way this should ever happen in a healthy car is if your battery is no longer holding a charge sufficiently. Like,
right.
That's basically it. I don't think there's anything you can plug in that would cause the electricity to be pulled from the engine to a degree, or any of the other essential systems. I don't know. I mean, I would assume there'd be electronic lockouts, like you said, a fuse or something similar.
Yeah.
That doesn't let you stop the engine computers from functioning and, you know, firing the fuel injectors or whatever.
Yeah. So anyway, because all this crap was happening and I'm like in the middle of an intersection, like, at, you know, with a stop sign, and it's, you know, it's residential, it's not like traffic, but still, you know, I'm like, what do I do here? So I just unplugged everything that was plugged into any USB port on the car, and I unplugged that battery thing, and it restarted. And I had to, as part of getting to my friend's house, I had to drive up a hill, and I proceeded to drive up that hill, and it started losing power again going up the hill, and I'm like, oh no. It felt like a transmission problem. Like, when
Also, here's the thing that's confusing this, right? So some people in the chat room are saying, well, it's not like you overloaded the battery. You just had just drained the battery, like leaving your dome light on, for the people who know what a dome light is or what. And if your battery is drained, it's not like your battery is bad and has to be replaced, but you've drained all the electricity out of it and you end up undervolting something and it gets screwed up, right? But then with the whole thing of going up a hill and you're losing power, it's like, well, it's not an electric car. The battery doesn't actually drive the wheels. How is that happening? Once you undervolt systems in modern cars and parts of your dashboard light up, the car may not be happy until it is convinced that all is well, because as far as it's concerned, all sorts of error codes are happening, not because parts of the car are necessarily broken, but because they briefly didn't receive enough electricity to function and are now throwing error codes because they're like, I don't know what's going on. The world has gone crazy. I, as a sensor, declare sensor bankruptcy. I don't know what's going on. And you have to sort of reset all the systems, right? And that could cause the car to say, like, go into limp mode or not provide power or whatever. But I'm giving these things because it's the hopeful answer, which is like, don't worry, just unplug all your stuff, recharge your battery, reset all the codes, and you'll be fine. But the other possibility that your car is breaking like British cars have for many decades is much worse.
Yeah, it felt bad. Like, I've never felt a car do this before. It felt really bad. Anyway, I made it up the hill. I got the rest of the way to my friend's house. And I parked it and it was fine. And then when I was driving back after the Rivian test drive, which I'll get to in a moment, the Land Rover, it had the check engine light on. I'm like, oh God, what did I break? But then today it wasn't on anymore. And the car worked fine all day today. And I drove it a lot today and everything was fine. So I'm assuming it was a temporary battery thing caused by that stupid battery pack that I should never have bought. I should have gotten the Jackery, damn it, but I didn't. I should have just gotten the same one again, but I thought I could go smaller and this other brand, and that was a mistake. Anyway, so the Land Rover seems to be fine now, but it, as
well,
I was...
sunroof accepted.
Oh, yeah, the sunroof is still broken. I consider that a win.
He's already got things that he's just sort of signing off as, that doesn't count as being broken anymore. It's just part of the car now.
Yeah. Anyway, so I did get to drive an R1T. This is not the R1S, the SUV. That's the one I'm actually waiting for. I've been on the wait list for the R1S for, oh, God, a long time. And every time I look at my date for when my R1S reservation is going to come in, it is a few months later than the last time I looked. Which is very discouraging. Anyway, I can tell you one thing. When my Land Rover was broken yesterday, I definitely, if there was an easy way for me to have gotten a Rivian that day, I would have. I would have sold the Land Rover that day and traded, like, gotten a Rivian. Anyway, but you can't get them. So, but I did get to drive it. I get to play around with the console. I get to ask my friend, like, you know, what he thought of it after months of ownership and everything. And ultimately, I am very impressed by Rivian. And so here's general high-level overview. It feels a lot like a big Tesla. And in lots of ways, you know, there's... And you can clearly, like... I would almost compare it to, like, Handspring versus Palm back in the 90s when, like, Handspring was a whole bunch of, like, ex-Palm people that, like, went off and formed, like, a better Palm, basically. And I think there's a lot of that in Rivian. Like, I know they've had some ex-Tesla employees that have joined Rivian. And there's tons of Tesla influence. If you look at the whole rest of the auto industry and the way they do things, the way they make cars, the way they're...
Like how everybody supports Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, but not Tesla, but also not Rivian.
Yes. Yep. But, like, if you look at the rest of the industry, they do things a certain set of ways. And then you see, oh, and here's how Tesla does things. And, like, it's, you know, very different, better in a lot of ways. Well, Rivian is in that other group. They're in the, like, Tesla group of, like, you know, lots of similar stylings in terms of, like, the how the screens are, how the dashboards are, what's in the screens, what's not in the screens, the layout of the screens, the general, like, you know, design, the UI design, the feature sets. Like, there's so much. Like, one of the biggest things I miss since having the Land Rover, I really miss dog mode, which is this mode of where Tesla, where you could, like, because it's electric, you can keep it running. You can keep the heat running or air conditioning whenever you want for a very long time. And so if we're, like, on a family trip and we're on a road trip and we have to, like, you know, go in to have a meal somewhere, we can leave the dog in the car and have dog mode keep the climate control running the whole time and show on the screen, hey, the dog is happy. It's, you know, it's 70 degrees or whatever. And so no one's going to break my windows and my dog is not in danger. All right. And that's a feature that I don't know how many cars offer that. Every Tesla does, and Rivian does. And I don't know if anyone else does. Like, you know, there's, like, the Land Rover has, like, a remote climate thing where you can start the car climate remotely, but it'll only run for 30 minutes. And then it stops, and it won't do it again until you go start the car physically, like, in person. So it kind of has that feature, but not a very good version of it. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of features like that Rivian and Tesla have, and no one else seems to, or at least doesn't have a good version of it. Lots and lots of that kind of stuff on the Rivian. But the Rivian is like a better Tesla. Like, they've clearly mm-hmm. taken a lot of influence. They've learned from Tesla's pluses and minuses, and they're basically doing a better version. It's a lot like if Tesla was run by an adult. Like, it's really...
They have stalks on the steering wheel.
Yes!
They have a steering wheel.
And I figured them out so quickly.
They actually have a steering wheel.
Yes,
it's a
complete circle, or at least close enough. I think it might have the flat bottom or whatever. But
it's got a flat bottom, otherwise why even bother?
Right. But yeah, so it's a circular steering wheel. There's a shifter, like a real shifter. It's a column shifter, but, you know, it's a shifter. yeah, there's the stalks and the knobs and the buttons and everything. Not a ton. You know, there's still a lot that's on the screen, but the screen is well-designed.
It's like, original Model S, which used to have stalks and everything like that, before they decided, no, we're moving all of that.
Right. Like, and I found the touchscreen to be very responsive. Like, the animations are really smooth. Panning around on the map is super fast and smooth. Almost iPad-like. Very responsive. I was very impressed by that, because the Tesla's not that responsive. It's gotten better over time. Like, the older Model S's were way slower than the more modern ones, but it's still Rivian was very good in the response.
And I think the quote unquote older Rivians also were worse, because a lot of these EV companies, the day they launch, their software is super janky, but they rapidly iterate on the software responsiveness because it's usually at this point not a hardware limitation. It's just that I don't know why they all have this problem, but they always launch with bad responsiveness on the touchscreens. And you're like, if you're worried, if you're a day one owner, is it always going to be like this? But you know, software updates very often save it. So you're getting to see the Rivian with the 1.0 bugs shaken out a little bit.
Yeah, but it's still like, I mean, I like, for instance, one of the clear benefits here is like this: the Rivian is designed for people who are still driving it. They're not making these big pronouncements. Oh, we're gonna have self-driving cars in 2 years or 1 year. Just give us an extra $5,000. Like, they're not doing that kind of crap. They're just and they have what Tesla calls autopilot, which is lane centering with adaptive cruise control. They have that. And it's by all reviews. I didn't actually try because we didn't go on the highway. But it's from all reviews, it seems like it's just as good as Tesla Autopilot. It doesn't do like, you know, lane change and stuff. But that, I never did that anyway because it was really conservative and weird, and I never really used that feature. But the regular, like, you know, lane keeping and adaptive cruise, I use that all the time, and I really miss that because the Land Rover has neither of those things, and I really miss that. But you know, this is a car that's designed to be driven by a human still, just to have these assistive functionality, you know, when you want them. But it still has a steering wheel. It still has a shifter. It still has knobs and buttons on stalks, and you can do a lot on the stalks. You know.
Can you open the glove box with your hand?
It doesn't have a glove box.
Oh, that's right. That's a big.
So that, anyway, I'll get to that in a second. But for the most part, like, you know, every Tesla vehicle has some like weird door handle thing. Rivian doesn't. Like, there is no like pop-out door handle. There are no gull wing doors. There is no weird like handle that you're not supposed to pull, like on the Model 3, where it's like, okay, don't pull this handle, and every time you get in there for the first time, you pull it, and you're like, oh, you opened the door wrong.
I did that to Underscore's car, I think, twice.
Yeah, me too. Like, there, you know, you just operate this car. It has pretty much regular door handles, and on the inside and outside, like, you operate it like a regular car, and it just works because it's designed to be a really good regular car, as opposed to Tesla is designed to be some kind of self-driving spaceship that no one's ever actually supposed to touch, and you kind of have to work around their constant desire to be innovative in superficial ways. You know, that's the experience of being a Tesla owner is like a lot of really nice things of very nicely driving cars. But every car has at least one of those dumb things that you have to work around, and you kind of have to forgive. Well, they're being very forward-looking. It's like, well, this thing is stupid and breaks. But anyway.
And it's great as long as you don't want a steering wheel.
So, by the way, I saw my first one of those in person, the first half-steering wheel Teslas. It looks super weird when you see it, especially like when you're sitting in a Land Rover, like in the sky, looking down into a Model S. It looks really weird. Anyway, I'm so glad I didn't buy one of those. But so the Rivian, it seems like a really nicely designed vehicle and it's thoughtfully designed. Like, there's all sorts of functionality in there that, you know, not just like the regular driving stuff. You know, that's one thing. That's a big thing. That's most of the appeal, is like the regular driving stuff seems really well done. But also, you know, they have all their cool utility features, you know, like this is the truck, so it had the gear tunnel and stuff like that. And there's all sorts of stuff like that. But it just overall, the feeling I got from driving it was like, this is a car designed by people who have learned from all of Tesla's mistakes, are doing a better job of that style, and are doing it in a much more like utility centered way, instead of trying to be, you know, too extreme just for extremity's sake. There were a few little things that I noticed. So some things that are, I would say, not negative, but neutral. No CarPlay, as you mentioned.
Oh, that's negative. That ain't neutral. That's negative.
So now that I've been using CarPlay full time in the Land Rover for whatever it's been, how many months? I think it's kind of a toss-up, honestly.
Oh, hard disagree
because
on that.
Because I'm also using the ProClip USA phone mount next to it. So I have a dual screen setup, which is really nice because I can have, like, you know, music on one and the Waze directions on the big one. Or I can actually, most of the time, what I do is I have Waze on both, because if you run Waze in CarPlay when your phone is on in a dock or whatever, on the phone, it'll show the list of turns. And then on the CarPlay screen, it'll show the big map and all the other stuff. So you actually, it's like having dual monitors. Like, you have more information available to you. So it's actually very nice. But when I'm like, you know, when I was in the Tesla, like driving to go get rid of it, that was just, you know, using just a car mount for my phone, like I always do in there. And when I don't have CarPlay, I don't miss it. If I, as long as I can have a way to have my phone screen visible and have Waze or whatever running on that, that's fine. And in some ways, it's actually better than CarPlay. So CarPlay is, to me, a nice to have. I hope they add it. I hope they have a software update in the future that adds it. But I don't need it. It's not something that I find a requirement, a hard requirement. So it's a nice to have, but not a hard requirement.
I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I strongly disagree, but I am genuinely glad that you feel that way, because that leaves you more options, particularly when it comes to fancy pants electric cars.
Yeah.
I personally find it to be very, anytime I grab my phone, which I don't do often, I've gotten better about over the years, but anytime I grab my phone when the car is in motion, even if I'm in a position where I feel like it's safe to do it, which it probably isn't, but that's neither here nor there. I just feel like whatever I'm doing, it's way less safe than doing this, either waiting or doing a similar thing using CarPlay. And so for that alone, I find CarPlay is very worth it to me. But to each their own, and not insisting on it like I petulantly do is certainly the easier approach.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I would prefer if it was there, but it's not as big of a negative to not have it as many people would feel, I think.
Like me.
Yeah. So I noticed also the regen braking was actually way stronger than my Model S, which I actually consider a good thing, because, like, you know, the other car that we now own is still Tiff's little i3. We bought that out for her, and I took a few drives in that when we were back, because I could, and it was there, and it was way more efficient and smaller than the giant Land Rover. So I took a few drives in that, and, like, that car has extreme regen. Like, you can come to a total stop very easily with the i3 as regen. And I actually like that. I like having very strong regen, because then I can choose how much of that power to use, how much of that to capture. You can actually do the, you know, partial one pedal driving a lot more of the time. Model S is it has good regen, but it's the Rivian was far stronger. I noticed that instantly. Some other downsides about it: no sunroof, as mentioned. Although I currently have no sunroof, so here we go. Only two cup holders in the front. I know this is like the standard number to have, but the Model S actually has four, at least the one I had, because you, like, in the little center console, you could set up two in there with these little, like, inserts that they had that were actually a really clever idea. And then there were also the main two, like, by your elbow in the middle. And there's oftentimes we actually want, like, three. It'll be like, you know, me and Tiff will have, like, a coffee, and then we'll also have, like, a shared water, or maybe a water for the dog or something. And so, like, oftentimes I want three cup holders in the front. This is a small, stupid thing, I know, but two is not enough, really, if we can have more.
No, regular non-fancy cars, you can put that water in your door pocket. They have a place for water there.
I know, but it's not as nice. Anyway.
I think it is. I think it's better for, like, that's why we keep the driver's water, as we would call it, right?
Yeah.
So drinks go in the cup holders. Our Accord has, I think, just two cup holders, and they're pretty big. But then there's also, in everybody's door, there's a place for a pretty big water bottle. So the kids have theirs in their doors. I have mine as the driver by my shin in my door. My wife's got hers in hers door. And it always annoys me when I see these reviews of these $80,000 luxury cars where they show trying to put even something as tiny as a little, like, you know, Poland Spring water bottle, and they can't fit it in the stupid door pocket because they made it so skinny that you have to crush the bottle to get it in. Total waste.
Yeah, and I don't.
I think the Rivian has. Does it have crappy door pockets? I forget. A lot of the
they
some
have,
of the EVs
they,
have.
You
like,
can, like, pull them out. You can,
oh,
like,
that's right. They have the accordion ones. Yeah, those are not good.
Really, I find them usually to be pretty good. But
no, like, what we're talking about is a door pocket that is a big, rigid plastic thing that holds a gigantic kid's water bottle, and you do not have to open or stretch anything. Like, it's not luxurious, but that's like what the utilitarian, like, minivans and Honda.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the Land Rover has. It's just a giant pocket. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I consider it a bit of a negative to the Rivian that it has very, very similar to early Model S's. It has an overly minimal front console and dashboard. So, like, it's, in fact, exactly the same mistake that old Model S has made. They have that, like, flat floor across the front where you have this giant spot in front of the front, like, between the armrest and the front dashboard area. There's, like, a flat floor. and you can't really put much there. Like, it, maybe if you have
that's for your purse.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I'm not kidding. That is for the purse.
But it's way too big for most purses. And you
I'm not sure you've seen most purses,
right?
Well, and you also you don't want to put much there because it can very easily tip over into your footwell, and that you don't want that.
The better ones put little fencing there, but no, that spot actually is really important. A place to put your gigantic purse that is not the passenger seat is actually a big design consideration for utilitarian family type cars, and I think that's what they're going for. But what they missed is what you're talking about, which is like you can't like on electric cars, it's easy to make it actually flat because you're like, hey, there's nothing going through there, like there's no transmission tunnel, right? It's really easy, right? But they forget, some of them forget, that you kind of do need something to kind of like a ship at sea to sort of hold that giant purse in place so it doesn't roll into anybody's footwell. And that's why a lot of the better ones have like not big like fencing there, but like little ridges or whatever to sort of make it so that if you were to put a soda can in there, for example, it wouldn't actually roll on your feet. It would just go back and forth.
Yeah. And it has like there's like a small little like, you know, kind of tray thing on the floor there, but it's not substantial like that. And that's I loved it in my very first model. I had two Model S's over the years. The first one had that flat floor thing, and there was just some aftermarket company that made inserts, and I just got an aftermarket insert that looked like a big regular console. And then when that lease sort of ended and I got the second one basically had that built in from the factory. Like it was a very similar kind of thing. They realized, oh, people want this, and they built it in. So I'm hopefully, with Rivian's what appears to be pretty clear success, hopefully the aftermarket companies will come around and make they might have already made some kind of like, console insert for that. Other than that, so compared to the Defender, obviously.
Oh, wait, going back to the tunnel for a second.
Yeah.
Doesn't it have the little walls that I'm talking about? I'm just looking at a picture of it, and it looks like that has the little walls that prevent it from going into your footwells. Did his not have that?
I'll have to take a look. Hold on.
2022 Rivian R1T interior.
Let me see. It has like little. It's like a small ridge.
But enough to hold a purse.
It's not. It's so close to the pedals. I wouldn't want to put anything there that could tip over into the pedals. Like that's not. That's to me a little too close.
I'm gonna put this in the Slack for Casey to judge. Yeah.
Anyway, so I will say, so, compared to the Defender that I've been driving now for whatever months, the Defender has a more comfortable ride. It's one benefit Land Rover has, they don't work very well, but when they do work, they're really good. Like, they're very comfortable, and the Land Rover was more comfortable. The Defender also has way more console storage. There's compartments all over the place with the Defender, and the Defender ones are also lined with rubber material because it's made to be an off-roader. So even like the cup holders have those little like rubber protrusions into them, so they like hold. They squish your bottle so it stays in place. The Rivian doesn't have. It has a little bit of stuff like that, but not much. It's much more like minimal, flat surfaces, not a lot of storage interior. The Defender also has the rear view mirror camera, which I love. Like the rear view mirror. You flip it and it becomes a screen, and there's a camera in like the tail fin thing that looks like a radio antenna. There's a camera in that, it looks back, and so you can replace your entire rear view from an optical mirror thing to a camera, and the screen is so high res and so high frame rate, you can't even, like, you instantly forget it's a screen, you just see better, and it's amazing. Like, I've never seen as smooth and nice of a camera and screen as that is, and it's so, so nice. Rivian doesn't.
I'm kind of
that.
Shocked that the big EVs don't have that, because that's becoming more and more common on just regular cars. Like you noted, like it's a Land Rover, and it's not even the latest model of Land Rover, and a lot of cars have that now. It's an option, like with the flips from mirror to screen. Why wouldn't they put that on all the EVs? They've got the cameras, they've got the computing and the screen tech. I guess they just figured, oh, we don't need that, we have the big screen in the dashboard. But it's the internal combustion engine seems to be getting that feature faster than the fancy EVs do.
Yeah, that's like the one thing that I think Rivian does lag behind in cameras. Like it has a backup camera and it's nice and high resolution, and it has that top down view that most modern cars have now that have a bunch of cameras on them, which is nice. But like the Defender still has way more cameras, like or it has like better like like the different views for the off roading modes that you can get. Oh, show me like my front left wheel, what's going on around that. Like there's more cameras, I think, in the Defender. Certainly, it makes better use of them. And again, that rear view camera is really, it's such a good feature. I really hope more people adopt it. And the defender overall, you know, the defender rides higher and everything. But on the plus side to the Rivian is electric. It's that makes it better in a billion ways. I miss electric so much, and I cannot wait to go back to it. It's so much better than gas in every possible way. The Rivian is way faster, way more responsive. You have all the benefits of electric, you know, charging at home, never having to go to a crappy gas station, the massive environmental savings. Like, it's just, it's so, so nice to be electric. Also, one little fun benefit. So one of the different experiments I've done over the months I've had the Defender is I keep and occasionally use MaxTrax traction boards. And these are these giant Australian plastic boards with all these little teeth on them. And if you or someone near you is stuck, you can stick these under the wheels and basically drive out. It's kind of miraculous how well they work.
That'd be a perfect candidate for the gear tunnel.
Yes. So the downside of MaxTrax is that they're huge. And also, once you have used them, they are then covered in sand or mud or whatever. And you don't really want to put them back in your vehicle. So I learned this the hard way. I have not yet had to pull myself out of anything with the MaxTrax, but I have occasionally pulled other people out of situations with MaxTrax. And it's a wonderful, you know, feeling to be able to help somebody. I love having that capability. But I had to then put them back in my vehicle. I first was storing them just in the trunk, and they're huge. They take up a ton of space in the trunk. And then getting them out of the trunk is hard if there's anything like in front of them, blocking them in. And I tried keeping them in a roof box, but that made my car too tall. There's all sorts of like roof rack mounts you can get for them. But the Defender is so tall stock that you don't want to put anything on the roof. If you ever want to go into a garage or anything, you can't. So any kind of roof mounting option was out the window for me. I eventually found a spare tire mount that worked. So they're mounted like on my spare tire, like on the back of the car. But this has its own challenges. First of all, it makes the car longer, and which makes it fit less well in garages in a different dimension. They're also just out there in the elements, so they're getting damaged by the sun slowly, and you have to like lock them. So I have like a lock that has to lock them in. I have to, you know, get a key out of the glove box to unlock it whenever I need to use them. So that's kind of a pain. So the Rivian, I knew the truck has not only, of course, a truck bed, but also the gear tunnel, and the gear tunnel is massive and awesome. But I thought, hey, you know what? Could you pop the frunk? The MaxTrax are very wide. Like, they're huge. They fit in the frunk. The frunk is so wide.
The frunk is huge on the R1T.
Yeah. It could fit four. I'm telling you, off-roaders, I have MaxTrax Extreme regular size boards. It fits four of them stacked, plus it still had enough spare room in there that I could put all my towing gear, the kinetic tow rope, the various like shackles and all that crap. I have a shovel. I have so much towing gear that I carry around in the Defender, and it could fit all of that in the frunk. So, oh my God, I cannot wait to get my R1S. I am like, anybody, if you work for Rivian, if you can like push a button, oh my God, I'd be so thankful. Like, I don't ask for much. But oh my God, I've been waiting so long for this car, and now the wait is, now that I've driven one and seen the utility, it's like, oh my God, it's the perfect beach car. Like, it is exactly what I need to drive to my house. Like, literally today I drove to my house. It involved driving over like 2 miles of sand, not like dirty roads, sand with the waves right there on the national park beach. That's what I do. This car is made to do stuff like that. And oh my God, it's like, I'm very happy with the Defender as an off-roader. The Defender is an amazing off-roader, but I would so much rather have the R1S as a general all-around vehicle. Like, it's such a nicer vehicle in the ways that I care about. It has more space inside. It's, again, electric. It's really good electric, too. Like, I would so much rather have an R1S, and I cannot wait. I'm watching all the resale sites, trying to see, like, you know, I'm honestly, I'm waiting for a yellow one. No one's selling a yellow one?
No. 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 Yes. You stop it. You stop it right now.
It looks
absolutely
awesome in the pictures.
It's fine. It's going to be the beach car. Yeah.
It's no.
Either, I either want the blue or the yellow. Those are the, those are my top two.
Oh, God, I'm going to vomit. Oh,
and the blue,
not yellow.
The blue looks cool, but I think the yellow looks even cooler. So I'm waiting for a yellow. But God, I
no.
just want like.
No, 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 no. Application denied.
I like
no.
the green one looks nice, too.
Oh, not yellow.
There's
anything
but
yellow.
A lot of good colors. You
know,
you're
going to sit here. Wait, wait. You're going to sit here after 10 years of slagging on white cars, and you're going to sit here like a jackass and say that yellow is the correct answer for something the size of a fucking bus?
Beep.
Hell no.
It's a happy, fun car. It's a little funny eyeballs in the front.
God, I'm so upset with you right now. You I was the, all the on board with this. No.
The R1S doesn't come with the... The R1S doesn't come with the gear tunnel, you know, but
no.
the good thing is that
the
car from the A-pillars forward is identical to the R1T, so
yes.
the frunk is the same.
That's why I asked about the frunk, because I knew, I'm like, because I was wondering, like, should I get the truck, you know, but ultimately I would have more use out of the, I would have more utility from the SUV, and, you know, because I want a lot more interior space, and I don't really need a truck bed for anything else, and so that's why, and I was so shocked that the frunk was as big as it is, because I thought for sure there's no way I'm fitting max tracks in a frunk of anything. But nope, they fit just fine, and four of them, and with room to spare.
So, oh wait, the yellow isn't like a Big Bird yellow. It's like a tan. It's called Compass yellow, but it is barely yellow. You should look at it on the website.
All right, let me look.
No,
it's basically metallic tan.
No, it's if
maybe
you see,
I
like,
overreacted.
Look at like real life photos of them, because like one of their press cars was yellow, so if there's a few like real life photos of them.
It's not Honda S2000 yellow.
That's
I think it's closer to that than beige, but it's hard to tell. You can't really see them in person, but if you just do like a Google image search for like R1S yellow or something, you'll see it's a yellow, you know. I mean, and this is actually a somewhat popular color now. Like if you look, there's a yellow Bronco, yellow Wranglers,
no.
you know.
No, I stand by this. I no yellow Wranglers, no yellow Broncos, no yellow Rivians.
What do you have
no
against
yellow.
Fun colors?
No,
that's
no,
the thing.
Not
and like,
yellow.
So
not
yellow. I currently have a blue car, and as a fun of a blue as Land Rover can produce, which is not very fun, but it's still a blue, and it's a nice blue, a very nice blue. But now I feel like, you know, for the Rivian. Rivian has a really nice blue that their quote Rivian
yes,
blue, which is like their bright one. It's a very nice blue. And if it turns out I can't get yellow and I have to get blue, you know,
you
that's,
can't get yellow.
That's
tempting. It turns out you cannot
no,
get yellow. I'm
I
telling you right
get,
now.
Just
look in the Slack. Honda S2000 yellow versus Rivian yellow. Do you see what
yeah,
I'm talking about here?
I see the comparison.
I think the Rivian looks fine in that color.
No,
I think the green is maybe more fun for the forest. Let's see. Is the blue maybe a little bit more beachy?
The blue is way more beachy.
Oh, and despite what Casey has said in the Slack here, I have a close-up picture of the purse holder, and I declared the walls purse ready. Look at them. They're pretty deep. That's like 4 inches.
Oh, Marco, this yellow is so bad. Just no. No, 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 no.
I don't know what your objection is.
I hate
now
yellow
I
for cars.
Yeah,
there is no better way to announce that you are very insecure in fill in the blank however you'd like.
What? With a metallic tan car, by the way, someone in my neighborhood has a white R1S now, and I think it even looks good in white.
I would say I think the white looks decent if you get the black wheels, which I like. My intended wheels are the black off-road wheels.
What are the off-road wheels
here?
Sport dark.
Here this.
No, that's two little sidewall. You know,
all terrain dark.
This all terrain.
That's
yeah.
it.
All terrain
yeah,
dark.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what I'm. This is what I want.
God,
right here.
I cannot wait for this trend of blacked out wheels to end. The rate I buy cars, it'll probably be fine because it probably take about a decade for it to stop, and that's when I buy a new car. But I know they've been in fashion for many, many years now. I cannot wait for it to end. I hate blacked out wheels so much.
They occasionally work, unlike yellow, which
I don't think
works.
I don't think I've ever seen. And I think the closest they've come to working is on off road
blacked
vehicles.
Out wheels in yellow and piss off both of you.
What I was going to say is, I think on off-road vehicles is the closest I've come to accepting blacked-out wheels, because it just kind of goes with the look of like, you know, not like military-style vehicles, but like off-road type of utilitarian things. But like, I'm talking about like on, you know, sports cars, sports sedans.
It looks like a B. It looks good.
Ugh, I like wheels to be not. They don't have to be shiny chrome, but you know. Like them to be matte finish silver, neutral colored. Like I do not want them to be black. I don't want them to be shiny black. I don't want them to be matte black.
It looks like a bee. It looks good. Yes, because when I want to think of something I want to look like an annoying piece of crap insect that all it does is piss you off and hurt you. Yes,
no,
that sounds wonderful.
No, the wasps are the jerks. People like bees.
Yes. Cue the stripy, buzzy things or whatever that image is that goes around every spring. But
it changes the ride height when you pick the different wheels.
Oh, that's true. I didn't notice that.
Like pick like the... Where is it? The 20-inch all-terrain versus the 22-inch sport. 22-inch sport lowers the car because they're sport. I mean, I know you can adjust the ride height of the car.
Is it just because there's less sidewall?
No, I think that you can change the ride height of the Rivian. Like it's an adjustable thing.
Yeah,
I think they're just lowering it when they show it with the sport wheels to make it look more sporty.
Maybe.
Anyway,
did you try the self-leveling thing?
No.
That takes a while.
I actually forgot about that.
I feel like it should be part of dog mode. Your dog should be comfortable and also level.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I cannot wait to get this. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. Like, you know, looking around the rest of the industry, there's no doubt in my mind now. Like, this is going to be my next car. It's just a question of like, how quickly can I get this car? Because right now, I believe my current estimate is like a year and a half out.
Yeah,
it's
the
terrible.
Company is struggling a little bit, so hopefully they're still around by the time. It's a tough gig.
No, but in many ways, it feels like early Tesla days in a lot of good ways, in the sense that, like, you know, they're rolling out all sorts of great features and software updates like on a regular basis. My friend said that the servicing story has been pretty good. That like he's only had a couple of issues, and they were minor, and they came to his house to fix them. Like, and this is over like, you know, over like 6 or 8 months. He's had it a while, so it's, you know, that's pretty good for a brand new car. So you know. I think ultimately, first of all, it would not surprise me if at somehow like Tesla bought them or something, because I don't know.
No, maybe, I don't like that either.
I don't
please,
want that
don't
to
say
happen.
That.
No,
I don't put that energy in the world.
You want like General Motors to buy them.
Yeah, I don't want. Yeah, again, I don't want that to happen. But they're so clearly like taking Tesla's playbook and just doing it better. Like I hope they remain independent and succeed like crazy, because they seem to be doing a lot of stuff right. And God, I'm so now, like, I almost wish I didn't go drive it, because now I want it even more, and I'm so impatient. Like, if anybody was selling a yellow one, I would probably justify buying it somehow.
I'm telling you that I was so like, I could not care less about a pickup truck. I understand that for some people they make sense, they're useful, etc. I am not some people in this context. I could not care less about a pickup truck. I do care about CarPlay, but other than that, this thing blew my mind. And I'm pretty sure I drove a quad motor, which was a mistake, because oh my good grief, this thing is so fast. And it weighs more than the Earth, but to have it move that quickly is just astonishing. Do you happen to know if it was a dual or a quad that you drove?
I believe they're all quads so far. I don't think they've...
Is that right? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think they've actually shipped any duals yet, because the duals are like the lower priced ones.
You got to fleece the whales first.
Yeah, right. I think all the launch ones are all
to try to stay in business. Yeah, I mean, both companies that
are
populated with...
fleece me. I'll pay.
I know.
I'm not asking for a freebie.
That's right,
I want to buy the car. Fleece me. Well, I'll even... You know what? I'll even pay the like the higher price, like, because, you know, I booked it when it was the lower price and they're going to honor it. But like now, if you book it now, it's higher. I'd pay the higher price if I can get it right now. Like, I want my freaking car. I miss electric so much, and this is so good.
Both of the companies that are populated with ex-Tesla engineers who are trying to do the Tesla playbook but better are also both financially and struggling with their finances and struggling with their ability to make enough cars to give to customers.
Who's the other one? Lucid?
Yeah, Lucid, the guy who runs that is the guy who designed the Model S, and he basically made a better Model S. And like I said many times, Lucid has the best motor technology in the entire EV industry. So if and when they go out of business, somebody's going to snap that up, because they have good stuff there. And the cars are pretty good, even though, you know, it's their first car, growing pains, blah, blah, blah. But boy, being a car company is tough, especially if you're not, you know, funded by, you know, an eccentric multimillionaire at the time, or aren't as good at getting government subsidies as Tesla was.
Well, Lucid, I'd be more wary of, just because they're selling into a much smaller market. Like, whereas Rivian is selling into pickup trucks and SUVs in America. Like, for God's sake, that's a massive market. Like, that's
you're no longer in the Lucid market though, because you can't stand cars. You need to be in a big SUV.
Yeah, unfortunately, I kind of like the, you know, it's mm-hmm. really nice not having like leg problems. Unfortunately. No, I mean, and I can see myself in the, you know, in the future if I want something smaller. Like I was more comfortable in the i3 because it is more of like a crossover height seating position, even though the car itself is tiny, but it's
like
it's
a golf
tiny
cart.
But kind of tall.
It's like a golf cart.
Yeah, like so like I just need to be careful not to get these like, you know, super low, you know, touring sedans anymore. Like get something a little bit higher. But even crossover height would be fine with me for that reason. But right now, you know, living on the beach, I still need something that's off-road capable, and there is not a lot on the market that is electric and off-road capable. I think this is it.
So, oh, the F-150.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's true. But yeah, I don't want to drive one of those.
The Hummer EV.
That wouldn't fit on the roads.
That
here.
Is also true. Hey, so to go back, if you were to build one, you said the god awful vomit inducing yellow, the black wheels, which I agree with John, not my thing, but I mean, whatever. Then for interior, I presume you would be contractually obligated to choose Ocean Coast.
Here's the thing. I originally had selected Ocean Coast, and they kept sending out these updates basically saying like Ocean Coast is delayed, that it's taking a while, and if you have Ocean Coast in your configuration, your date might be, you know, softer and squishier. So I thought, you know what? Great. I don't really care that much. I'll switch it to the black one. And I switch to the black one, and what happens when you change anything about your configuration your estimated date disappears, and then like a month or two later it refreshes and it's further out. So that's what happened. I thought I was going to get closer by changing it to black, and instead it pushed me out another 6 months.
Oh no.
So
I mean, that might not be
point,
related to
the interior
might not
be
related
be
to your
purple.
Change.
I'll take anything, like, just
yeah, if they were better on their website, they'd let you know if those changes had any effect on it, but it could just be that everybody got pushed out 6 months because, again, the company is struggling a little bit.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I expect stuff like that, honestly. Like, it's fine. As long as they are healthy long-term, that's ultimately what I want, because they seem to be doing, like, there are so many companies that all make very similar vehicles. So it's like, you know, if one of them stops making a vehicle or goes out of business, it isn't that big of a loss, whereas, like, you know, if you're a company like what Tesla has done for a while, up until fairly recently, where you're like the only one in a certain role, or now what Rivian is doing, like they're the only ones doing what they're doing so far for the most part. You know, you can get some of what they're offering in different vehicles, but not all of what they're on, not this whole package. So no one else is doing this. Like, so if they go under, we're out of luck for as long as it takes for the rest of the market to catch up and do something. And then when the rest of the market does something, it might not be as good. Like they might, you know, do things in the more traditional, you know, badly designed, bad user experience, no future looking features, all this stuff. The way that, you know, if you look at like, you know, like what BMW is doing, you know, like first of all, ignore the giant kidney girls for now, I know. But, you know, one of the vehicles I was looking at was the iX. Because the iX, I think, has a lot going for it, and the reviews all basically say, yeah, it's hideous, but it's actually really nice to drive. So there's a lot going for that, but there's a lot about that car that I'm like, you know, ultimately, it would be a lot less useful to me. First of all, it can't go on the beach, not any kind of off-roading capability like that. It's not made for that. But even just for like day-to-day stuff, it's too small. Like it's still like it's a larger vehicle in terms of footprint, but they put like no storage space in it. The trunk is all weirdly small. It's narrow and short. They made a bunch of weird decisions with that car that like, and then the, you know, the infotainment system is all this like huge overwrought, you know, BMW complexity there that like there's a lot of hits and misses in that. You know, some of it's good, a lot of it's really, you know, experimental, future looking. You know, they had like and some of that's there's a lot of misses in that. So I just want my R1S. I just want it now. And I know that's the stupidest, most impatient thing to say. Like, I know that. I don't feel good saying that. But that's how I felt after test driving the R1T and looking around and seeing how much better it would actually fit my needs. Like, you know, Rivian as opposed to anything else. I'm just like, oh, man, I hope this next year passes by quickly.
There are two R1S launch editions available, including one in Katona, sir. On Cars and Bids right now.
I have a search alert. I've been watching them come in for the last few months. There has not been a single yellow or blue one. There is a blue one on Auto Trader in New Jersey right now.
Come off it. Come off it. If you want the car, who cares that? As long as it's not yellow, who cares?
No, if he's going to overpay by buying it aftermarket by somebody who's taking advantage of the supply and demand imbalance, he should get the color he wants.
And the good thing is, like, the resale prices are actually decreasing pretty quickly now because there's a lot more supply than there used to be. So they're actually coming down to more reasonable levels. But I think they seem to be making colors in timed color batches, because, like, the ones that hit the resale sites are all the same groups of colors at the same times. So I think they're, like, delivering them. All right, you know, this week our factory made some black ones. This week our factory made some gray ones. Like, that's kind of how it feels. I don't know if that's actually how it works. That's kind of how it feels on the resale sites. I've only seen one blue one for sale. It's in New Jersey. And honestly, if I had had the title to the Land Rover with me on that trip, I might have gone and traded it for that. I was very tempted. I'm like, this is stupid. I shouldn't do it. I almost did it. I was very close. If I had the title, I probably would have done it and just been really stupid. But, you know, ultimately, I should just wait for mine. It would be a lot cheaper. And, you know, it's the right thing to do. But I don't know. YOLO, you know, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Katona, I forget exactly where Katona is. I just remember being off the Metro North, but
it's not
can't
far.
Be far from you. It's yeah, not. Exactly.
No, so, if that was a better color. Also, very few of these have the off-road wheels that I actually would want. But the blue one in New Jersey does. So we'll see. I'm not going to buy it. God, I want it. I'm not going to buy it.
Well, please buy that one, because at least the blue is very pretty. It's so pretty. All right. Let's do some titles. Just not yellow. Not fucking yellow. Good God. I should.
Basically tan.
I need to be better about it.
I keep calling it yellow. It's tan.
No, look, like, the version of it on their site is much more muted. When you actually search for the pictures of it in person, it looks like it's much more yellow.
No, it's because John is tunnel visioned and everything is viewed through the lens of Honda. And yes,
I'm just saying, like, yellow is yellow. We know what yellow is.
Well, the S2000 is like neon yellow. It's so bright.
It's yellow. That's yellow. You know,
it's really
RGB with just
yellow.
The R and the G and no B.
All right, let's do some titles. I shouldn't yuck your yum. I need to be better about it, because like what you like.
I'm looking at another picture online of Compass Yellow. It looks totally different than the website.
That's
so
what
I say
I'm
false advertising on the website. It's not even the same color. It's false advertising.
It's clearly yellow. The
look
only
at,
question
look
is
at this
how
thing.
Bright. Now,
no, look
them,
at this. Compare
some
this
of the
to the picture.
Almost orange. Like, it's weird. Like, it's,
no, it is. It's not even the same color.
It's very hard to tell from online pictures like what this color looks like.
They should be sued.
No, don't. We won't see you. Just get me my review. All right, let me see the titles. How are we doing on titles?
No, look at the one I just put.
Right.
So Casey,
that's
Casey
a, like,
put one in here or whoever.
A certain light.
Right, but look at the one that's above that, above Casey's thing. Tell me that's the same color car.
I know. That's I'm telling
these
you.
These are both real life pictures. Neither one of them is a marketing photo. That's not the same color.
I think it is. I think it's just
no.
one is in bright
look
sunlight.
How different
and
that
one is not.
They're both outdoors in sunlight, so it's not like, you know, weird
no,
temperature
like a,
halogen lights are affecting it.
I disagree.
It.
Yeah, but
this
it could,
is like
it could also be
super...
like, it could be like, you know, what phone cameras are doing.
It was a Samsung. Did a Samsung take this picture where it looks bright yellow?
That's the thing. It's so hard to tell from pictures, like, how a color is going to look in real life.
Yeah, well. Anyway, that S2000 looks like the picture. It's Big Bird yellow.
Yep.
Ugh. All right. Title, sorry.
All right.
I like Fleece the Whale. This is the after show. I do like it quite a bit.
There was a good.
Can you pop the frunk? Is also.
Oh, good. I only know it through my dog. I really liked that one.
I can't give him the carrot fast enough, is my favorite.
No, it's too long.
That's within limits. I can't give him the carrot fast enough.
Yeah, it is long, but it's within limits. And, like, you know, because dogs, you know, they have such short memory. So I actually, I have the carrot in my palm of the same hand that the needle's in. And so I do the injection. As soon as the injection's done, I drop the carrot out of my hand. Like, it's super fast. Like, it's shot out, boom. So
yeah,
I'm hoping he connects it.
I had to give my dog allergy shots, and it was pain, too.
Yeah. It's soul crushing. Because you can't, like, you can't explain to him why you're hurting him. He just thinks you're hurting him twice a day. Like, oh, God.
The good thing is the little scruff on the back of the neck, which is where I did the allergy shots,
is
one of the better places to give dogs things because it's not as painful.
Yeah, usually he doesn't usually, but, like, you know, sometimes he'll flinch a little bit and I'm like, I hit something, you know.
My
or
dog yelps.
Occasionally he'll yelp, and that's the most heartbreaking.
But the thing is, my dog yelps like he's being crushed in a vice when I put his doggy sweater on, or her doggy sweater on. Sorry.
Oh.
She doesn't like putting on her doggy sweater, but the family likes to see her in it. So you try to put her paws through the little doggy sweater holes, and she's like, "Ow, ow!" It's like, "Come
aww,
on,
you can't."
I'm being
do that
so
to
gentle.
Her.
I'm so gentle with her little paws, putting them in the little holes in the sweater, so carefully putting them in. It's like the wool is like burning her. It's like, all right, okay, you're being a little bit dramatic. It's like I'm making sure I'm not stressing any tendons, not making her stand awkwardly. It's like the doggy sweater is the worst thing that ever happened to her. And to be clear, I would never put her on the doggy sweater. It was up to me. My family demands it.
But and you have to do it though.
And yeah, and then it's you.
Yes,
that has
I
to
have to do it.
Oh no,
because it was like she has a holiday sweater that she wears on Christmas morning. It's a whole thing.
Why is that your problem? Make Tina do it.
Oh, I'm the dog whisperer.
Yeah, me
during,
too.
During my whole COVID convalescence, the dog always wants to be in the bed with me, so she's healing me.
She
senses my sickness. She comes, if something goes on outside, like the doorbell rings or something, she goes and investigates and explores, but then she comes back and scrapes at the door. So I don't let back in, and then you know, she'll check out what happens elsewhere, but she's basically been staying in the room with me.
Oh, all right. Fleece Whales. It is the after show, but that is my favorite, I think. I still prefer, I only know it through my dog, but I would do the carrot one if we must.
Yeah, I think the carrot one's the better of the dog titles. Yeah, let's see. Titanium.
I like the carrot one. It's my favorite.
Yeah, me too. I vote carrot.
All right, well, then that's quorum, and I'm not going to veto it, so that works. All right, create new episode. I'm a little sad we didn't have time for the other after show, but I understand.
Pretty long.
Yeah,
we did go long, but
yeah, this actually took longer than I thought it would. The review thing, but because I had a lot of diversions.
I'm pleased that you enjoyed it because I was very surprised how much. I mean, I figured I'd like it when I drove the R1T, but I really liked it a lot more than I thought I would. So I'm pleased that we agree in that regard. All right, let's see how I screwed this up. Hit save, and hopefully it lets me. Oh, team. All right, cool. We are normal time next week, right?
I believe. Let me double check. Yeah, it's a regular week. Yep. Cool. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening live. And, yeah, we'll talk to you all normal time next week, and we'll see how many cars I have.
Oh, gosh. You're gonna be cruising. Bring a trailer and cars and bids, and I will bet by the end of March you will have some way somehow found yourself in an R1S.
The yellow ones might be hard to find, especially he'd have to see it in person to see if it's the yellow he wants, because apparently there's more than one yellow.
No, it doesn't appear as though they're actually yellow ones don't appear to be arriving to customers in high volume yet.
I mean, somebody has them because these are customer pictures that we put in the Slack. Like, this is not, you know.
Well, one of them, the person said it was like a forum thread, and the person's like, it's VIN number 003. So that's probably an employee.
That's not reassuring. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So I one of the press cars was yellow. So I don't really know, are actually customers getting these yet? I don't think we actually know that yet. But certainly none have been for resale because unless. If you find one, let me know. As far as I can tell, there have been none at resale, truck or SUV, in yellow. So anyway, wish me luck. All right, bye.
All right, good luck.
Yeah, bye-bye, yeah. People. I'm sure you're really wishing it, Casey.
I mean, I know I need to backpedal because I shouldn't be yucking your yum like that.
I think you should.
For
funny.
Me, well, I viscerally hate yellow cars, and that car in the car nerd chat that I brought up innumerable times on the show, one of the guys is, you know, he does very well. He doesn't have, you know, anyone else to, you know, no wife, no kids, nothing like that. And so he has, what does he have? A Porsche Cayman, an X5 daily. That's 2017, 2018, something like that. And a fucking bright yellow, I forget the formal name for it, but the Z3, but the M version, you know, it's not an M3, obviously it's a Z3, you know, whatever. Yeah. I forget what it's called.
Is that the clown boat one?
No. It's a convertible one. Fair question. Perfectly reasonable question.
Actually,
but
the clown boat one, I think would look pretty good in yellow. Actually, I think they actually made it in yellow.
Stop.
Didn't it look good in any color?
it doesn't look good in any color. It's a
That's a car that's so ugly you have to have it in a weird color to make it like, you know.
Okay, I will give you half credit on that.
Yeah.
I will give you half credit.
Like, if you
on
just
that.
Get that like in black, like that's boring. You know, you can't do that. If you're gonna have an ugly car, get an ugly car in a cool color.
I don't know, but anyway, he got this. The most recent of the three cars is the, I can't remember the name of the damn thing. Z3M maybe is what Chris Vanasso is in the chat saying. He's probably right, but anyways, Z3M M Coupe, I think that's it. Well, anyways, he got this in yellow, and I've been beating the shit out of him for a year since he bought the damn car, because I just viscerally hate yellow cars with all of my being. But I need to be better about not yucking people's yum.
Oh, I'm gonna get a yellow Lamborghini.
I would love for you to drive it to my house, because you haven't visited in a long time. And to be fair, I haven't visited you in even longer.
I'll make you drive
but
it and take pictures.
That's fine. I'd be happy to drive it. Yeah, actually, I don't want to drive it, because I think I would want to replace Aaron's Volvo with it. And it is way too expensive for our taste, but I would want one real bad. Oh, man. All right. We really need to say goodbye to live people. Goodbye, live people.
Bye, live people. Thanks for listening. See you next week.